The Football Pod with Paddy and Andy.
The young guy on it that was on the under 20s last year, he turned it up to me halfway through the game because you're too old. I was like,
he was back. You're his coach.
Tell me you dropped him.
Download the OTB Sports app and subscribe to the GAA podcast feed now.
OTB AM with Gillette. Put your best face forward with our new and improved razors.
It is 7:30. This is OTB AM, and like us, you probably haven't slept very much last night. Maybe you got up in the middle of the night. Maybe you stayed up all night. Maybe you didn't go to sleep at all. And you know what? That is perfectly fine this morning, because this doesn't happen too often. We don't have a whole pile of teams that are literally world beaters. We have even fewer moments where we expect Irish teams to be literally world beaters and they go on and actually deliver on all that promise. And for many of you, the only other time in your life where you may have actually properly celebrated a gold medal in the Olympic Games was in 2012 when Katie Taylor won gold. So for many of you, last night, this morning, was only the second time in your life where you got to properly celebrate an Olympic gold medal. July the 29th, 2021 was that moment. Paul O'Donovan, Fintan McCarthy, gold medalist for Ireland on the water in Tokyo, and we will have reaction for you all throughout the morning. We will speak to people close to those rowers, people who have watched this journey over the last 5 years and beyond as they have become, I think what is fair to say, Adrian Barry, national heroes at this point.
Absolutely class on, wasn't it? I must say. And it's really, the other important thing to say this morning is it's taken the shine off your performance yesterday as well. So that's great. Not many people talking about the fact that your Joe Canning interview, let's call it, from yesterday. But no, it was, look, it was phenomenal. I'm sure you were the same as myself last night. I timed my run brilliantly. I was up, got up maybe sort of 3 or 4 minutes before the race started. So it was absolutely ideal. And I really sort of planned that I'd be get up, watch the race, lads get the business done and sort of head down again. But it didn't really work out like that because the TV coverage, they were scrolling through every McCarthy from Mick to Larry and everybody in between. And it was great and it was compelling viewing and it was brilliant to watch. And it was such an outpouring of love for the two lads. And it's just like Paul O'Donovan now moves himself into fairly rarefied territory in terms of multi medal winning Olympians from an Irish point of view, and just incredibly brilliant stuff at the end of a mad old 18 months. It was brilliant to watch.
Yeah, and it was a brilliant moment for everybody who was gathered around our televisions last night, I think it's fair to say. If you are just waking up this morning and you missed it all unfolding live last night, let's have a listen to how George Hamilton called this gold medal for Ireland last night.
World champions in 2019 in a quarter. Green light, off they go. Expect the Germans to start swiftly, and indeed they've done just that in lane four. They were fastest out of the blocks in their semi-final, and this combination of Rommelman of the bow and Jason Osborne, you heard it, exceeding. They're home and hosed, they're ahead by a length. It's Ireland from Germany, and history is made on the water in Tokyo as Fintan McCarthy and Paul O'Donovan win gold. Gold for Ireland! Gold for Ireland, silver for Germany, and the Italians come home in third place. And that is one more chapter of magnificence from the men from County Cork. Brilliant, sheer brilliant. There's never been an Irish rowing gold before. Gary and Paul O'Donovan won Ireland's first Olympic rowing medal, the silver in Rio. And now Paul, with Fintan McCarthy, has won Ireland's very first gold medal.
Yeah, absolutely incredible. And then obviously a little while later, the brilliant moment of actually hearing Aaron Navin, which just, it's something that is the most obvious thing that people talk about when they win gold medals in the Olympics, but you kind of forget that it's actually coming, and you forget that, oh, this is something that we don't experience all too often. And as I said at the top there, Adrian, the only thing that a lot of people will have to compare to this is Taylor 9 years ago, and that's it, really. That's it. There's been, you just have to go way back to find anything that's close to this level of pure joy that you can attach to an Irish sporting moment at the Olympic Games.
Yeah, totally. Well, particularly for athletes who've had no question marks about their performances, right? And like you can look at it and, these medals are not going to be removed or questioned, let's say. So there's a delight about that. And I think for people waking up on as well, even in terms of, you got a good sense of the race there with the commentary, like everybody's very familiar now, particularly with Paul O'Donovan and Gary previously, with the types of start that they used to make to a race, that they'd be well behind, but had absolute confidence in themselves and proven ability to pull the field back in. And it wasn't really the case last night. They actually made quite a good start to the race, which I was reading quotes from Paul afterwards saying that it almost caught them a little bit by surprise, but and they still knew. It wasn't a case that they'd burned themselves up over the first 500 metres. And yes, they were still behind. They were 1 second 40 down on the Germans and Italy after the 500 metre mark and then started to... There was some relief from it on. I don't know if you felt it, but it was clear from very early in the race that it was going to be... Like, look, I was listening to Niall O'Toole on the Olympic show yesterday, and I just thought, after listening to him, there's no way we can't win gold here, and that's dangerous territory. Like, it's very dangerous. But it did, that notwithstanding, it did feel at very early in the race, we're guaranteed at least bronze here. It was so obvious because the top three crews had cut adrift from the others. But the Ireland stroke rate went up, the speed went up, it went higher than the Germans at one point. So at that stage, you knew it was just a matter of time before they were going to overhaul them, which they did, I think, on the three-quarter mark, got the canvas ahead, quarter of a second up on Germany. Italy at that point were gone. They finished up, I think it was at 8 seconds or something behind in the end. The German stroke looked shot. He really looked he looked gone, where the two lads were very composed and very very strong right up to the finish. So yeah, just incredible stuff. Brilliant race, really compelling.
The camera angle when they go through each 500 metres completely skews how you're viewing yes. things. So George yeah. Hamilton obviously has more information than we have at home. He obviously can see exactly who's in front of who, or maybe he's just commentated on so many races during these games that he knows exactly how to judge the camera angle. But after 1500 metres, he was saying they're still in front, the Irish. And I was like, that is not how that looks on my television. Right. I was like, oh God, what is happening
the
trick
here? Is to keep an eye on those little balls, the little boys in the middle Correct. Of the in the middle of the race, so you can see, because you're absolutely right, it is totally confusing and very hard to get a steer. And even watching, and we should mention Sunita Paspora, obviously, who yeah. went a little bit later on and had a huge disappointment, but even watching that race, I was hoping upon hope, no, I'm looking at the wrong boy here, she must be a bit further up than that, and unfortunately it wasn't the case with her. But yeah. you're right, it is such a confusing sport to watch.
Delighted to say that Mark O'Donovan, world and European champion rower, is with us. Mark, how are you getting on?
Very good, good morning, how are you getting on?
All good. Was there any doubt in your mind watching that last night that it was going to happen?
I was a bit shook there, all right, at some stage just after coming through the 1,000 metres, but I had full belief that they did it, but geez, they left it tight for a while, but they really pulled it out. The confidence out of the two lads is phenomenal, you know. They did an amazing race, and I think they had everyone gripping at the edge of their bed last night. So they put on a show, but I couldn't believe the sprint they had towards the end. We always know that they kind of negative split the race anyway, Jesus, like when the Germans were in such close touching distance, you just don't know what would happen.
That's exactly it, that it there wasn't enough room for any error whatsoever going home in those 500 metres. Like, did the Germans almost surprise you with how close they were at the end?
Yeah, and I suppose the lads, they did leave that little bit of, they didn't have any room for error, and thankfully it all went to plan, but it was so tight. I just couldn't believe that they could pull out of 150-200 meters, pull half a boat length, or just that amount of distance. Like, that's phenomenal power from the two lads, and I, of course, the Germans are going to go out hard to try and get out on top of the Irish and try and sit there, and it really did work, but as like the better crew won, thankfully. So
if we just talk about Paul O'Donovan just for a moment here, have you seen anything new from him? Have you seen a higher level from him over the course of the last few days?
But I suppose they broke a world record there, so like they're obviously on top form. It's great to see, because after all the years of training, it's very hard to know, does the performance go down, or does things go stale? But it's very clear that the two lads, and of course Paul, is they're both on top form. So yeah. it was great to see.
Like, the story around Fintan is incredible as well, and kind of trying to actually burst through that glass ceiling and there's a lot of people, like we had Kieran McCarthy on the show yesterday from the Southern Star, saying that he was actually talking to him in a pub in Skibbereen when the race was happening in Rio in 2016. And it was that moment that kind of crystallised for him that he could achieve something like last night. And there was an almighty battle for the boat. It wasn't just Gary O'Donovan, it was also Fintan's brother Jake, who was going for a place in that boat over the last couple of years as well. So just, could you put it into a little bit of context how good Fintan McCarthy is? Because he's somebody that a lot of people have only become familiar with recently.
I suppose, Fintan has always been tipping away. He's a phenomenal athlete, great engine, lovely personality, lovely character. But that really shouldn't matter in it. It's more about performance. He, over the past few years, basically, he's so good he's able to kick a silver medalist out of the boat and a brother, which, you could almost say that there's, you're going to favourite your family more than anything, but it was so black and white that he was better than him that he got into the boat. And he was tested many times to get into that, and he came out on trumps. The best man came out on trumps all those times. So hats off to Fintan, because it's highly competitive, that boat, and as we saw last night, they needed the best man to be in the boat, the two best men to be in the boat, because it was such a high demanding race.
What were you thinking, Mark, with that start? Paul spoke a little bit about it afterwards, and it almost caught them by surprise that they were so quick off the blocks. I mean, for them, I know they were still a little bit behind, but what were you thinking at that point? It doesn't seem like there was any concern that they were going to burn themselves out, even though it was a bit quicker than usual for them.
Yeah, even though it was quicker than usual, I suppose just from watching them over the last couple of years, we just know that's the way Paul likes to go out. And I wasn't one bit concerned over the period of the race. It was just when the Germans weren't fading off as quick as most crews usually do, that's what was concerning me.
Yeah. And Paul, now he's 27. We were talking about it a bit earlier on, he's moving into really rarefied air in terms of Irish Olympians and, double medal winner, two different Olympics. What's the future for these guys? Almost future Olympics. Rowing is a sport that does lend itself to, you can be a little bit older and still have that that brute strength.
Yeah, thankfully, rowing is quite easy on the joints, so as long as they don't get any major injuries, there should be nothing to impact their performance over the coming years, because you're not really loaded, there's no impact. And the future is bright. If they want to keep going, it's going to be amazing. And sure, then you've got Gary that will be in the mix also, so I could imagine that would be pushing the performance even up again, because if they go on for Paris, which it's only 3 years away now, it would be highly contested. And also, as you mentioned earlier, Fintan's brother Jake, he would also be fighting for a seat. So it could be a tough couple of years ahead if they wanted to do it. But they're in the right place if they wanted to, and it isn't too far away. So hopefully they do, and it would be great to see them break more records once again.
The McCarthys want to take the boat off the O'Donovans, full stop, is what I'm hearing here, Mark.
Yeah, twins against the brothers, yeah, how bad. Yeah, we'd pay money to see that.
How close? We got an insight into Jake last night in the TV, and you mentioned about personality earlier on, but how close is he then to getting his foot in?
Well, poor Jake there now, last year, was it a year ago or so, he got knocked down by a bus in Dublin, so that wasn't great. That really hindered his performance, and the poor man was crippled. He couldn't really stand up for too long, so I'm surprised that he was even able to train there towards the tail end of the year. So that really kind of made him out of the contest for Tokyo. I suppose things being delayed helped him, but it was a little too late for him. So Paris is a little bit more in line of what's actually achievable. So they're phenomenal. So he's a great athlete as well. And like, of course, like Paul helped his brother Gary, Fintan's doing the same with him, you know. They're all tight-knit, everyone's doing the same training, so let's wait and see.
Mark, sorry, go for it, Adrian.
Sorry, you've been in and around them, obviously, Mark, for a number of years. You know the lads very well. I was listening to Niall O'Toole, who'll be with us shortly, on our Olympic show yesterday, talking about the lads being red-hot favourites, been streets ahead of the rest, and, you know, the levels of confidence out of them. What is it about them that, you know, technically or whatever other way, that makes them so good?
The million-dollar question, eh? I suppose, like, they're just phenomenal athletes. They've got great engines. Probably some, like, you need great physiology to be anywhere in that league. Even getting into an A final, B final, you need great physiology, and then everything else on top is kind of the determining factor. Like, their timing of actual feeling of rowing the boat is phenomenal, you know. I know a lot of people would say a lot of technical coaches around wouldn't like Paul's rowing style, or even Dominic would be giving out to him all the time about this and that, and then Paul would have an argument saying why it's better and why it feels better. And right, basically a technical coach, generally, they've always been out of the game for so long, they don't really know. They're giving their insight, but it's more about rowing the feeling of it and actually being in tune with the rhythm and the water, and seeing, and then also in sync with each other. So it doesn't care what it looks like, as long as it's fast.
So Paul,
what do you mean?
Sorry, I was just going to ask that. I'd say, Adrian, what you're about to ask, like that, those conversations between Paul and Dominic. So Paul is winning those arguments.
Oh yeah, sure. So like, if you think about like, generally rowing is quite the prestigious sport, and it always brings you back to kind of Hindley and GB, and GB always have this technical model of being picturesque, and it would be quite it would be like a dressage with the horses, you know. And so in terms of rowing, then if you bring one of those characteristics over, you'd say the arms from the shoulder joint out to the wrist should be a straight line, is what the technical coach would always advise. But over the years, people have developed a slight bend in the elbow, and also a bend in the wrist, because you can kind of suspend more weight off the handle of the oar more efficiently, rather than just purely hanging. Like, you get a better feeling, you're a little bit more connected, you're stronger in your shoulder joint, you're stronger in your arms, and it's less load, even though it doesn't look as graceful or as easy as straight lines, but that's not what the human anatomy is good at doing. You have to do what's right for that, and yeah, the two lads are doing it brilliant. And then you can go too much, which will obviously hinder your performance, and you'll start tightening up, and you'll be excessively loading the muscle. But that's just one example.
It's a great example. That's really interesting stuff, Mark. And thank you so much for taking the time to come on the show this morning. Really appreciate it. And we'll chat to you again soon.
Take care. Thank you very much.
Cheers. Mark O'Donovan there with a really interesting insight on Paul O'Donovan, and a little bit of, I guess, trying to explain to you and I, Adrian, the genius of the man, from somebody who knows what he's talking about. OTBAM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning. Start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Plenty coming up between now and 10 o'clock this morning. Let's have a look. We're going to have Niall O'Toole with us in just a moment to give his reaction to the gold medal for Ireland last night. The sports page is coming your way at 8 o'clock before James Skettle joins us for Thursday morning hurling, where there's a couple of big fixtures at the weekend and a certain retirement yesterday that we want to chat to James about. Paul O'Connell then, myself and Adrian were chatting to him before we came on air this morning, and that piece will be coming your way around 25 past 8. There's an Olympics update coming your way at 10 to 9. Mixed fortunes outside of the gold medal for Ireland this morning. Sunita Pospure, as Adrian mentioned, not managing to qualify for the A final, and Annalise Murphy is flying this morning, so we should have some clarity on her position at around 10 to 9 this morning. Celtic are out. They were beaten by Midtjylland last night. OTB's resident Celtic nut Enda Coll will be with us at 9 o'clock before Sue's television picks at 10 past 9 if you want to find some spot in your calendar that doesn't involve the Olympics this weekend. And we're checking in with Ross and Harry Byrne again at 25 past 9 to talk about their the Dublin Simon Run at Home, which is a great charity event that they're involved in. Right, at 7.51 on this Thursday morning, delighted to welcome Niall O'Toole to the show once again. Niall, how are you getting on?
Fantastic. What a night. Amazing.
Have you slept?
Yeah. No, I don't think most of Rowing Ireland haven't slept. And most of anybody involved in rowing will not slept for the last number of nights. It's been an incredible journey for everybody this week. And yeah. It's been a real ride for us all, so it's glad that it's coming to an end.
can you try and sum up where your emotions go during those 2,000 metres earlier?
Well, I think we're going to talk about, obviously, the boys. We're going to talk about the boy and obviously Sunita, unfortunately. But yeah, I think it's hard. I mean, the Olympic final is it's 7 minutes, and you built up all of your life for it, and it's very difficult to put out all of that energy in 7 minutes and do it correctly without being overly emotional about it. And the guys are, I just watched the guys being interviewed afterwards, and they have something else running through their veins other than blood. Seemingly, they just are as cool and calm as you can possibly be. They did exactly the same thing they did in every other race before. They started slowly and slowly built momentum through the race. To do that in an Olympic final, to stay that late, you know, in a kind of way, and come through kind of that late. Again, it's nerves of steel stuff. Phenomenal athletes, phenomenal achievements. They were by far the outstanding crew of the championship, and everybody's saying that on all the stations. Everybody's saying how fantastic and they look and how fantastic they row. So yeah, it's an amazing achievement. Clearly, our first rowing gold medal at the Olympics. So it's I can't put into words how chuffed everybody is within Irish rowing. And long may it continue.
It's obviously layer upon layer upon layer that you need to rely on for those 7 minutes. And I'm just interested in the mental layers that are involved there, because as you say, I'm not sure if you're racing and you've got no experience of the other crews or no experience of your own form, there might have been a tendency to perhaps panic with 500 metres to go or with 1,000 metres to go. But that belief, that knowledge of the other crews, that knowledge of their own form against those other crews is probably what gets them over the line in the end.
Totally. I mean, you have an internal game and an external game, and if you're too internal, you're going to be tense, and you're going to be really, really tense, and you're going to overly maybe work that first half of the race and not having anything. And the real problem, I suppose, in especially in those pressure race situations, is to go off script. And if you have a really good race plan that is really working for you, don't try to do what somebody else does poorly. Row to your strengths, and that can be difficult if you're in the Olympic final and you know you're out of the medals in the first 500 meters and you have to claw your way back through. But it's the self-belief that the boys have a strategy, they have a weight plan, they back themselves, they know they have this, they know they row well, they know they're really efficient in how they row, they know they have massive engines, and they know they let the guys go and they know they're going to track them back. And that's, it's that self-confidence in really those crosshairs of all of that pressure from the Olympic Games. You know, you talk to the boys, it seems like they were just out for a normal spin. They don't seem, they are all about going from A to B as quickly as you can and forgetting about the consequences of everything. And that's real performance. Relaxed control, focused attention really is the key to optimal performance. And they can just blank out everything else, look down their lane, do their race strategy, deploy it every time the same way, and nobody can live with them. And I think it's on those big days when people try to do something unique that they haven't done before, they make mistakes. But these guys, they know what works for them, and they practice it in training. And more importantly, if you're the Germans in that last 500 metres, you know the boys are gone. It's so who else can we keep behind us? And if you're racing the Irish double, that's what you feel. You know they're going to come through you, and it's all over. So let's just stick in the silver medal position here, and that's what happens when you're the German double and you're dying on your feet, and you've nothing else to give, and the boys cruise past you. It's all about the minor medals, and that's what happened.
When people became, and I mean on a mainstream level, acquainted with the O'Donovan brothers in 2016, I think what the first emotion was kind of, are these guys for real? Is this the real character of the lads? When they were listening to their post-race interviews in Rio de Janeiro, I think what you've said there, their entire mentality, and you can throw Fintan straight into there as well, yeah, that mentality of just going from A to B, I think the way they race is almost proof that their chilled out nature is absolutely authentic. My question to you is, why is that authentic? Why is that the way that they are? How have they managed to shut out all the noise, shut out all the hype, and actually be one of these really strange sporting moments where they're fully layered on with hype, but they've managed to deliver on all that hype and that expectation?
I think it has to come back with, you know, I think Dominic has done a great job with them. I think they really realised at a very early stage, they understood at an early stage that it's really, they can't control anybody else. They need to focus on themselves. They need to focus on good rowing. And rowing is a sport that you can do that. You're really not impeded by the opposition at all, clearly. And I think Dominic has really, really honed that. And I think really when you get really, really good coaches like Dominic who make you know what's important. And the really important things about rowing, and the boys have it down to a T, and Dominic's drilled this into them, is control those, live those small little moments in every single stroke. Don't get beyond that moment. Don't think about the last moment. Just be in those moments. Optimize every moment that you possibly can to go as fast as you can, and understand any deflection, any distraction outside of that, any thinking about media, most of these guys, Paul especially, isn't even on social media. You won't see him. You can't find him anywhere. He doesn't get distracted by anything, and he's really kept his world, especially Paul, has kept his world really, really small, and he's done that for a reason. And the reason is not to be distracted, to stay in those critical moments that really optimise his performance, and that's why they're so successful, clearly.
Niall, you mentioned the German performance earlier on, and it was up to a point, obviously, very dominant. The thing that stood out for me was after the race where the Germans were so ecstatic that they'd finished second. Obviously, yeah, even everybody within the sport knows how good these two guys are, and to run them close in itself is an achievement almost.
Yeah, I think, listen, we're sitting here this morning and we look at the medal table. Just to give you an idea of where Ireland and how difficult it is for these big countries who have millions and millions of pounds going into rowing. Ireland is level with China this morning in the Olympic medal table for rowing, with very few races to go. We're ahead of Great Britain. We're ahead of Canada. We're ahead of Germany. we're ahead of Russia. So just to give that gives you an idea how important that medal was. I think that was their first German medal, if I'm right. That was the first medal for Germany. So a hugely important medal for Germany. They may win the eights. They may not win the eights. We don't know. But just to put it in context, level with China, ahead of US, Canada, Great Britain. They were having an absolute mare of a regatta. And so just give you the context. So the Olympic medals are really, really hard to come by. And they're hard fought. And we have some of the, you know, financially, I'm talking about the cheapest medals out there, if you like. So that's the excitement from the German crew. And also, I think they probably realised they gave the boys as hard a run as they did all in the last 2 years. They were overlapping them at the end, which was, I suppose, a surprise for Roman and Osborne.
What's your understanding of the relationship between the two lads? Now, I was listening to some of the interviews, like you were saying there, and reading some of the quotes this morning, and Fintan was talking about there was a few grunts and there was a few shouts coming from his angle. What's your understanding of how this relationship has built up over the last couple of years and how it functions, I suppose?
I think it's very businesslike. I think clearly when you have a big squad of people and you know, it's very matter of fact. It's very business. We're here to do the business on the water. Clearly, Paul, you'll always have somebody who's a little bit more dominant, and clearly Paul has the kudos, and he's probably a little bit more dominant within the crew in that respect. I think but Fintan, you know, knows how to hold his own as well. That's very, very clear. And you know, if you're going to row with somebody with such a pedigree of Paul, you know, you have to stand up to the plate. It makes you a better athlete. To sit beside Paul every day and watch him perform at the level he does on the ergon in the gym, that pulls the best out of you every day. And obviously, Fintan has to come up to that mark, not just physically, but had to grow mentally to match Paul in all of those areas. And, you know, he needs to, you know, Paul is dominant, but you have to have there has to be respect between the two people, and certainly Fintan has earned and gained that got respect. There's no question about that. But you know, sitting behind Paul must be absolutely phenomenal. It must be terrifying at times, because he goes. I can't imagine what it's like in the bout seat when Paul goes. You have to go with him, and he is operating at a different level from anybody else. And you have to hang in. And not to say that Fintan is purely hanging in, but it must be great to be rowing in front of him, and it must be also a bit. Little bit scary.
They don't show it. If it is, they definitely don't show it.
No, they definitely don't show it.
You were, as somebody who competed, I think, in Olympics, now if I'm right, at the age of 34, Paul would be 30 going into the next one. Obviously, Fintan would be younger again, and the other lads coming through, like, who knows where they're at in 3 years' time. But in terms of future prospects now for these lads, this is not over by a long shot.
No, it's not over by a long shot. There's a little caveat. I mean, we're looking at 2024 Paris, three months away, is possibly going to be the last time that we have lightweights in the Olympics. Okay, so it'll be the last hurrah for that crew, if you like. Now we don't know. I mean, there's suggestions that Coastal Rowing will take those lightweight slots. So yes, it will be the last row. From a Rowing Ireland point of view, we're definitely going to have to pivot in this kind of next Olympiad and beyond to more heavyweight rowing, you know, to fill that gap. But certainly, I mean, certainly Fintan hasn't even reached his prime. Paul is not going anywhere. He's only going to get better. He's only going to get more confident, even more brutal, if that's possible. Again, you don't know whether Gary's going to come back in. That's going to be interesting to see the journey of overall the whole squad of lightweights. Can they put it up? Can somebody put it up to Paul and Fintan? It's a very, very competitive environment in Cork, clearly. It's getting the best out of all the athletes. But yeah, there's definitely another Olympiad in these guys, and possibly the last one from a lightweight perspective.
That's interesting to hear. I presume, just the last one for me, Niall, I presume that the Irish rowing world is alight this morning, that your phone has happened, that, like, yeah, while the rest of us who dip into this every couple of years and say how phenomenal the lads are and sure aren't they great characters and all that sort of stuff, you're living and breathing this every day of the year. I presume that the rowing community this morning is alight and delighted.
We're just super proud. I mean, we know everybody is embedded in this sport. Everybody knows how difficult it is just to be at, even rowing at a novice level is quite a commitment. We're just super proud of the system. I think everybody feels a part, genuinely. The community is so small, guys, that everybody feels a genuine connection to the guys. The guys are very open. The whole squad is very open. We all feel a part of the medal. literally a part of the medal. And because the community is so small, and yeah, we're all just immensely, immensely proud. We couldn't be pleased for the rowing. It's great for our sport, for everybody to see it on the telly, if you like, and see how wonderful it is. And we're just made up. We're absolutely made up. And it's not only this moment, but all of the small moments that are to come, and welcoming all of those new people who want to try the sport. I think you'll find rowers have a real passion, a real love for the sport, and to be able to welcome new people to the sport and give them the experience of rowing, which is such a wonderful sport to be involved in. I think everybody's looking forward to that, and there's going to be a lot of people in coffee and water coolers asking, yeah, you do a bit of rowing, yeah, do a bit of rowing. What do you think of the boys? And this general conversation is we're all looking forward to having, you know.
How much did that manifest itself in a real growth at grassroots level after Rio? Because you'd assume that if that was a true thing that happened, then what's going to happen over the next few months is going to be even bigger again.
Yeah, I mean, I was involved in coaching myself, and it was hard coaching with coping with the volume of the people coming through in Rio. You could see the effect it had on the senior team, the results in Rio. And I think what we're mostly excited about, you know, we can explain the boys, it's respectfully to the NRC, to the National Rowing Centre, it still is a skid boat, and everybody feels like it's a skid boat. Even though it's based in the National Rowing Centre, the girls are really very significant. The girls' bronze is hugely significant from that perspective, because we have Galway, we have Cork, and we have Dublin represented in that. And that's super exciting. In my own club, I know we have a bunch of really, really talented girls, and for them to be able to hang out with Emer Lamb, who's in the four, I can't tell you what a big effect that's going to have on the sport. We're definitely in a new era for Irish sport, especially on the women's side, for Irish rowing, especially on the women's side, and I just can't wait to see the amount of especially young girls. And it's really, really important as a father to a young girl. It's really, really important that they have these really strong role models. And Emer's an exceptional role, as all the girls are in that four. So I think we're really excited about the girls' side of the sport, and it's going to be great to see. And then girls, they improve a lot quicker than the guys. So hopefully we can see people coming into the sports inspired by the four, and get more people through in Paris. Yeah,
just to circle back to the point you're saying, obviously when it comes to the women's four, they're obviously their event is in no immediate danger whatsoever. But
no,
I mean the fact that the gold medal that Ireland have got is in immediate danger. And in fairness, we were chatting to Kieran McCarthy yesterday, and he was saying it's actually lucky to be in Paris. Is there some sort of Katie Taylor-esque campaign on the behalf of Irish rowing that could save it again beyond 2024? Because as you say, Niall, it does alienate a type of rower, a smaller type of rower, from reaching the Olympic Games, which, let's face it, is always going to be the pinnacle of this sport. It is the way a lot of people get into the sport, and it is what inspires a lot of people. To not have that role model, to not have that lightweight role model, it's not just going to be detrimental to Irish rowing, it's rowing in general. So surely there's some sort of argument to be put forward.
Broadly, the lightweight community have been fighting this for a very, very long time. It seems like a tide that's kind of just very, very hard to turn. It looks like it's set to change. I mean, you know, lightweights have been lobbying to stay in the Olympics, and really hard. I mean, it was tough getting in, and it seems to be hard staying in. I think again, as a lightweight, you have to be a 70 kilo average for the crew. And if you look at the other crews, every crews, they're well over 90 kilos, 95 kilos, some of them 100 kilos. So it's especially for countries with kind of maybe smaller populations, it really excludes rowing completely for them. So it is a problem from a sport that is trying to reach into, like, it, you know, pertains to be a global sport, you know, to be cutting off almost half the globe to the sport, with what is essentially a essentially, if you're not 90, 100 kilos, you can't enter the sport as a heavyweight in the open category. And people can say yes, but there's lightweights doing well at the Olympics. They are the exception, and they're not the main. And it does close off the sport to a lot of people. We will, as lightweights, as a community of lightweights, we will fight tooth and nail to keep it in. But again, it's the coastal rowing seems to be this kind of sexy, kind of more kind of dynamic, kind of like TV-based kind of sport. And I think they want to get it in to kind of get the eyeballs up. But it's going to be, we'll do our best. We'll fight as hard as we can. We'll roll up our sleeves. But it's going to be very hard to turn the tide on it. And unfortunately, at least we'll get another medal out of it, one or two medals out of it, please God, and milk it for what we can.
On Sunita Pospure then, Niall, just before we wrap up, obviously desperately disappointing for her overnight. Was it simply just not a good enough start for her?
Hugely disappointing. Like I cannot tell you how cruel this sport is. Mm. I mean, or how cruel sport is. I'm absolutely devastated for Sunita. You know, she's one of the forebearers for women's rowing in Ireland. It's almost hard to talk about it this morning. And you know, if you look at the four, for instance, most of the four wouldn't have been rowing when Sunita did her first Olympics back in 2012. And it must have been very difficult for Sunita sitting in her room with all of that year, all of that grind, all of that grunt, and watching, you know, what is a very short success curve for that four, and then having to go out and kind of slay all the demons of all her previous Olympics. She looked very, very nervous at the start. I didn't like the water for her. It's a nasty little chop across the top of the water. I know it's the same for everybody. She doesn't really row that well in rough water, I don't think, from what I've seen in all her races. So it's devastating. And just on that point, if you talk about the cruelty of the sport, if you look from the point of view as if you take that stat about the girls and Sunita, and you think of the fact that Gary was probably in the air when the guys was flying back to Japan, when flying back to Ireland, when the guys were winning their medal, it's absolutely brutal. Sunita, again, I'm really devastated for her. And she will be gutted today, clearly. Gamelin, the Swiss girl, Chan, the Chinese girl, and the Dutch girl, I can't think of her name, but they haven't beaten her in maybe 2-3 years. And to be beaten by competition that you know that you have, and especially in the single, because it's such a psychological game in the single. Once you get your foot on somebody's neck in the single, you can have it there for years. And she didn't execute well enough, and that's really gutting for her. She's slow off the start, but she didn't get going at all in the race. I don't know whether it was pressure or nerves. I'm just really devastated for her. The whole rowing community is devastated for her. People want that. She was probably a year, maybe too late for her. This time last year, she had Olympic gold, and that was it. She was streets ahead of everybody else. It might have been a year too late for Sunita. She's 39. I hope, and if she's listening, Sunita, please go on to Paris. I would like to see her maybe in a four or a prayer. Get out of the single. She's been 15 years in the single, which is absolutely brutal. Get out of the single, get into the four, get yourself a medal in Paris and retire. But hang on for 3 more years, Sunita, please, because we think you're awesome, and we want to see you in the sport, and we want to get you what you truly deserve, is that Olympic medal. So a big shout out to Sunita today. I hope she's feeling okay.
You think she'll still have it in 3 years?
I think she still has it. I think she's 39 now, but I think she's 42. By the way, just to give you an idea, she's a machine. I mean, all of the girls train with and together, okay? And if you're, again, not just like Paul, if you're sitting on the wrong machine or lifting weights with Sunita and you're in the four, she's making you both go places in training that you've never been before. She is the bar setter from a physiological point of view. She is the bar that everybody tries to reach within rowing Ireland. How far are you off Sunita is the question the girls would be asking themselves. So she had a big effect on that four, absolutely 100%, and the women's group in general. So even if she lost 1 or 2% over the next 3 years, she still has the bandwidth to get into any crew boat. I hope she gets out of the single. I really do. I think another 3 years in the single would be very difficult for her, especially carrying the Olympics, Tokyo with her. And I hope she gets into a crew boat and gets the medal that she truly deserves. I hope she stays going. And if she will, if she still, again, if she loses a couple of percentage points, she's still going to be good enough in 3 years' time. So please God, she'll stay going. She obviously needs time to reflect, her and Jasper and Kasper, and get together as a family and see how that works for her. She also needs to get herself, a bit more balanced, a bit more stuff going on in her life, maybe a career, more career focused, more education. But I know that's something that she's been doing for the last number of years. Maybe she has some balance, get into a crew boat and go for Paris. That would be my suggestion. Humbly.
Niall, it's always a pleasure listening to you talk about rowing. It's been a night of mixed fortunes, I think it's fair to say. Thanks, there guys. At the end, but what a moment it was for Fintan McCarthy and Paul O'Donovan. Thanks so much for being with us.
Thanks guys. Talk to you.
Niall O'Toole, three-time Irish Olympian there on the line with us. It is 8:15 on this Thursday morning. You're with us here on OTB AM, which is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. We got a packed show still to come for you. We'll hear from James Skehill next as we talk hurling. 8:17 on this Thursday morning. Welcome back to OTB AM. Time to turn our attention to hurling. We've got two big quarterfinals this weekend. Dublin against Cork in Semple Stadium and Tipperary against Waterford in Parky Cueve. Both of those games.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere. Visit Hyland.com.
Games happening on Saturday. The big hurling news, though, this week is that Joe Canning has retired from intercounty hurling, and his former teammate James Skehill is with us this morning. James, good morning to you.
Hi, Owen. How are things?
Yeah, good. So, did you see this coming in the end? I know you were with us on Saturday saying that maybe it was time for Joe to go, but I guess the couple of days were left, and obviously there was the interview here on OTB AM yesterday morning where we perhaps suspected that maybe he might just hang on and maybe think it over a little bit longer and come back for one last hurrah.
Yeah, well, when I spoke on Saturday, I was expecting, you know, a couple of terms out of the Galway camp, and I didn't exactly outline who, but you know, obviously the media, the way things are, that they'd focus in on him being with his age and whatnot and what he's done in the game and so far. But I didn't expect it so, I would say, soon after the game. I thought there maybe that anyone who's making a decision would go through a club campaign and maybe make it in the winter. But, you know, he's always been his own man. He's always been quite measured in what he's done on and off the pitch, let's say. So when he came out with the news yesterday, I understood he'd be very content in his decision and happy in the decision he made.
How big a loss immediately is he going to be to Galway?
That's actually, you know, that's even too hard to quantify, to be honest, Owen, because, you know, you never really get the true sense of greatness until it's gone. Like, you know, and like, you know, when other intercounty players retire across the country, you feel nothing. But then when one of your own retires and he's been as good and as charismatic as he's been, it nearly feels like a death. Do you know what I mean? I don't want to over-exaggerate that, but you know, he's an terribly important, a difficult individual to replace. You can't. There's no individual in Galway that's going to replace him. That's just a fact. And there's no one that's coming anytime soon that's going to replace him as an individual. You know, I think it's going to be very difficult to get that kind of effort, work ethic, skill, you know, excellence, big scores. It's not there at the moment, to say. So I think the Galway team is going to need time to rejuvenate. But he himself, like his talents, you have to understand, right, that his talents were so good at a young age that the man was under such pressure to perform, you know, early days, like when he was seen at 15 and 16. And for him to perform consistently under the scrutiny of the public and the Galway public, especially hurling people, so he performed consistently and under extreme excellence the whole time, has been remarkable. You know, if any young player goes into a team one, I think hugely he needs his time to develop and to really be allowed to make errors but he never got that opportunity. You know, he was expected to be scoring 110 and 112 every day he went out, and that was none more so evident in his debut. Not his debut, but his big debut game, which was against Cork in 08, and he had 19, you know, scoring 212. If someone did that nowadays, you know, I think the media would lose their mind entirely. You know, so it's very hard to get a measure of the person that, say, he's lost to a team until you actually start a new campaign. But, like, he's just, it's going to be a very, very huge void, a huge void for Galway to fill.
You were playing that day in 08, I assume, James, were you?
Yeah, I was, yeah. I was. And again, it was just in real time. Like, see, I suppose at that stage I was playing with him for, you know, 6 or 7 years. I can't really remember, but I wasn't really too surprised, you know, what he was able to execute. But what really surprised me was that he was able to execute on the certain type of people he was marking. Like, people would forget he was marking the rock, caught a ball over his head, out-muscled him for a goal, split the rock open, you know, and roofed, you know, and that was huge. Then he went on John Gardner and took John Gardner for a run around Thurles, you know. So it wasn't that he just executed, like, the skills of the game and everything that you want to see in a game on a nobody. Like, he executed on two of the best Cork defenders ever. You know, that was huge. And he really announced himself on the scene. And probably, I think, if I'm honest, I think going, it probably set him up for a difficult, you know, I would say career in the immediate aftermath of that game, because that was nearly the expectancy for every day when he went out, you know, even though that's an impossibility. You know, how do you expect a young fella to score 212 every day against top-tier opposition? But he would always strive to do so, you know. Like, I'm a big fan of the NFL, and Bill Belichick was the coach of the Patriots. He said, you know, talent sets the floor, but, you know, the character sets the ceiling. And he had great character, you know, to perform in big games. You know, he never went missing. Like, I can tell you for sure, there's no guy person or no person across the hurling world that said that dad went missing on a big game. That's the last thing he did. He always showed up and got Galway through. And, like, only for him, specifically 2017, to be no Ireland for anyone, because that wonder score he got. And, you know, He deserves enormous credit, and I hope he's happy in his decision, and that he can have happy retirement.
It's like, we've been chatting to Niall O'Toole about Sneada Paspura there a moment ago, and he was just outlining how brutal top level sport is. And when you look around at some of maybe the heartbreak that certain counties have had in hurling over the last 10-15 years, you can put hurling right in that bracket as well as a truly brutal sport at an inter-county level. Even when you look around the country at the moment, and even on Saturday alone, you'd Canning and you'd Patrick Horgan and you'd Tony Kelly, all guns blazing, and thinking to yourself, like, I mean, all three of these are likely to not win the All-Ireland this year, because Limerick are, chances are, going to be All-Ireland champions once again. That talent and that commitment doesn't guarantee you anything. And it might be some mild comfort, though, to people that at least there's 2017, because in such a brutal sport, it could so easily have been a career without any All-Ireland.
Yeah, exactly. Like, it's a sport that can be influenced by one man, or can't be dominated by one man, you know. And that's why the Kilkenny teams of the previous years, you know, their team was so dominant, and their management team was so dominant, and they were just so ahead of the curve that they got so many in Ireland. And, you know, I mentioned yesterday to someone that, you know, Joe, for me, is the best hurler ever in the history of the game. I don't care what everybody says, he's the best hurler ever. And I would hope that the team accolades don't, you know, outweigh his strength in that conversation, because, like, obviously Henry Shefflin and the likes have, you know, Tinner Ireland, but it was the fact that when you're talking simple individual terms, Joe was the best ever. He was the best hurler ever, and that'll never go undoubted in my mind. But like that, I just don't think the supporting cast around him, me included, were I suppose good enough as a collective to get him over the line more than once. But I think that one Ireland one would be huge for him, for his legacy, and just to know that all the efforts that went in throughout the years, you know, culminated in a victory. Albeit we got one, but still the fact is we got one, and one is huge in comparison to none.
James, good morning. You've touched on it there a couple of times, just about his influence in the team. It's hard to say it about the 2017 team necessarily, but over the years, looking at Joe from the outside looking in, carrying Galway on days, were there days in your position where you were looking out the pitch going, we're not on it today, and geez, we really hope that this guy has one of his games and he can carry us over the line?
100%, yeah. There's been days that started off with my very early days with him, like when we were 14. You know, it's like, where's the red helmet? You know, and it's just puck it down there and see what happens. You know, there were some days, it wasn't just at senior either. Like, there was days we had, an under-21 game we played Clare in 2009, and it was just simply, you know, I had 14 teammates, but I was only looking for one. And where is he? With every ball that we had to hit out, I was looking for him, and he ended up scoring 4-7, which you know, 21s, penalties, overhead flicks, overhead pulls. You know, he was just awesome. Like, and his influence over the team is huge. And like, you'd always try, you'd always hope that he'd get into the game early and kind of settle early, you know, not maybe get a handy free, you know what I mean? Just get something on the board so that he could take off, you know what I mean? And he'd nearly carry it, because you'd be, and I said it there a minute ago, I won't say questioning the supporting cast, but like, when you've got a talent as high as Joe is, and then the people around him aren't quite as high, you're going to look for him every time and hope that he carries it through. You know, and that's another point I made about the Kilkenny side of things, is like, Shefflin has massive supporting talent around him, you know, not at the same level as Shefflin, but very, very close, you know what I mean? So it was easier for Kilkenny to find a balance in those big games, where for us going back through the years, you know, I won't say Joe was on his own, but God, he was given the mantle of having to carry that team. And he did it well, in fairness to him.
Can I ask you on that point then, just to raise an interesting question, because he spoke to the lads yesterday, obviously before he announced his retirement, about the injuries, and the niggles was the word that he used, that had sort of maybe taken his toll a little bit on him. He's only 32. You bowed out of the game yourself, I think, at the same age, not that long ago. Do you think if he was at like a Kilkenny or a Limerick at the minute, or one of those teams that are competing for sort of regularly, that he might have put the niggles and that stuff in his back pocket, but the thoughts of the slog and the carrying of the team for another 12 or 24 months were sort of too much for him?
No, I don't think so. I disagree there, because again, you have to understand the character of the person, and you know, he was always team first, despite what anyone might think about, you know, the personal accolades and whatnot and scoring records. That I don't think that ever weighed in his mind. I always think he was team first. And if he was going to come back, he'd be all in or all out, you know. And I don't even think he'd look at Galway's, I suppose, position, if you like to call it, in the hurling world at the moment, and let that weigh his decision. I would think that if he was able to offer something positive to the team, he'd return, you know, on the same capacity as he had at the minute. But like, again, like he mentioned himself about the injuries, like, people have to understand that, you know, he's probably, as we speak right now, he's probably walking around, or maybe in bed, I'm not sure, but he's probably in pain in some capacity. You know what I mean? And like that, he spent an awful lot of his career in pain, through injuries and through niggles and through getting, like, he received an awful lot of, even though people mightn't like to highlight it, he did, like, he received an awful lot of off the ball, see what's the pun, you know, how would I say, attention. You know what I mean?
Whether that be punishment, almost, like, James. Is that
yeah,
too
punishment,
much?
Exactly. It's really like, you know, it's really like a gladiator arena. Every time he went in, he was the focal point for every single defender. And then every defender, whether it be in a club game or inter-county game, would try and measure themselves off Joe. And the good guys, like the J.D. Delaney's or the Jackie Tyrrells, would try hurling, you know, to get a fair measure. But then you get some guys in other capacities or other teams that think that the best way to get a measure off him is to beat him. You know what I mean? And like, he's more times that he's got knocks to hands, wrists, elbows, you know, all over the place, just through a sense of brutality. Like, so that goes back to my point that if he was going to come back with Bowler, like, he'd be all in, right? You know, maybe the body just probably suffered a bit more than it should have, you know what I mean? Because all the great players get different unnecessary attention because, you know, others aren't capable of marking them in the fairway. And I think that was a Joe received an awful lot of that. And especially when Portumna were going high, or flying high, should I say, throughout their club campaigns, you have clubs in Galway that try and knock them down a peg or two, if you get me, you know, metaphorically speaking. So I don't think if he was in a Kilkenny or a Limerick or a Cork or whatever you say, that he'd be going back, you know, straight away, because with him, I just think that if he wasn't able to offer himself 100%, you know, that's why he would retire, in my opinion.
Yeah, just two very quick ones for me, just on Joe, before we move it on. What is there? I was kind of asking that maybe on the basis of James Moore, that if the niggles sort of disappeared in 6 months or in 8 months, that at that still fairly young age, that we might see him again in a Galway shirt, or do you think that's there's no chance of that?
There's a chance. I can tell you, there's a chance for everything. Stranger things have happened. You know what I mean? I don't know is the honest answer. I'm a bit torn because, like, again, I said at the start of the show that he'd always be very measured, you know, and calculated in what he would do. And, you know, if he's making a decision that this early after the game, and especially in the dressing room after the game, I think he would have mulled over, you know, quite a bit, and he would have been quite methodical in analysing that, you know, maybe if I do, you know, shake injuries, or if I do come to the club campaign fairly good and I shake everything, will I come back? And, you know, I think he would have thought about that, you know. And I think he came to his decision content that wasn't going to be a possibility. But, like, strange things have happened. I don't know, Les. Like, it's just so hard to know. You know what I mean? If he if he does get, you know, a break and a mental break, and that's the big thing, you know, get away from, you know, the sport, I suppose, intercounty sport, and just take a break and, you know, recharge the batteries on a personal level, let's say, and get away, you know, mentally from the tolls of being an intercounty player. And maybe you wouldn't know. It could be a snowball effect. He could get a bit, you know, the bite could come back. You just don't know. Like, you just don't know.
Yeah, I don't know. Yeah.
Yeah, I would say no initially, but again, anything can happen.
Who knows? You trained with him for 20 years, I mean, between the underage grade and all the way up.
Yeah.
What, because you were both starting most games, were you never sort of been peppered by shots from him, or were you generally, like, how did that work?
How do you mean?
Like, you know, when the teams were split up in training and you were both on the first team, that you would that he wouldn't necessarily then be firing in on you, or were you going to training every day taking 50 shots?
He fired in on me more times than once, you know. to give you the kind of an example of the power of his shot, like, you know, we had in Gerlach Nan's time, he brought in these baseball machines, you know, the main machines that throw out the baseballs. You see, brought in MLB, like, and so then the Oaks used to go up to 120 kilometres an hour, and, you know, you'd have some chance to save them, you know. When Canning threw over a ball, so you just have to get out of the way, you know what I mean, because it just came with such power, and he's caught me more than once, like, and in a few more private parts than I'd like, you know what I mean, but it was just the nature of it all throughout the years, you know, that, like, you'd always be facing off, and sure, always trying to best each other as best you could, you know what I mean, and sure, every time I lost, so that's kind of that was the nature of it all, I say. But he was, John, you said 20 years there, and God, that's a lifetime for some people. And, you know, it's kind of, it's an end of an era. Like, it's sad in one way, you know what I mean? It's the end of an era. And I only said yesterday, it feels like yesterday that we were, you know, talking out on 13 years of age, the two of us. And it feels like this morning, you know, that we were winning minors at 21. And now here we are at his retirement, you know. So it's just, things go so quickly. So there's a huge appreciation on my part for having him, you know, in my life at that time, let's say, and on the teams that I was on, because without him, I certainly wouldn't have won what I won.
Yeah, what a player. Unfortunately, we're basically out of time, James, and there are two quarterfinals to preview. We will, I think it's totally worth getting your memories of Gerlach Nan's baseball machine, though, in fairness. We wouldn't have got that if we went too deep on these quarterfinals. Dublin against Cork, Tipperary against Waterford. What are you most looking forward to this weekend, and how do you see them going?
I'm really looking forward to see how Tipperary will go against the Waterford running game. Waterford have good momentum at the moment, and I think that they've set the blueprint for Liam Sheedy's defence. So I'd like to see what Liam Sheedy and his team bring, you know, after the Limerick debacle, to a Waterford team who have great energy, and to a Waterford crowd who have great, you know, momentum at the minute. So I'm looking forward to that battle. I'm also looking forward to how Dublin cater for Cork's movement. I'm interested to see how Matty Kinney, you know, will try and combat their forwards who are going well at the moment. And, you know, they're two very interesting games, and, like, games nowadays are extremely hard to call. I've got the two Galway games wrong, obviously, but I do think in this instance, I think Tip will shade Waterford, and I think Cork will shade Dublin.
Right, very good. Well, enjoy the weekend's hurling, James. We'll chat to you again next week.
Thank you, guys.
Cheers. James Gehill there on the line with some brilliant Joe Canning memories as well. He'll definitely be a loss to the All-Ireland Championship, and once it gets back underway again next year. Right, so we've got plenty more Olympics coming your way after 9 o'clock, because things are going quite well for Annalise Murphy, actually, over the last little while. She is right back into contention to make the medal race after a brilliant morning's work on the water in Tokyo. So we'll get to Will O'Callaghan later on. We'll also be chatting Celtic with Enda as well around 9 o'clock. But first, we got the chance to catch up with Paul O'Connell yesterday afternoon.
OTB AM.
A €30 million state-of-the-art interactive rugby experience is set to open in the heart of Limerick City in autumn 2022. We are delighted to welcome Munster, Ireland and Lions legend Paul O'Connell to the show this morning to talk about this exciting project. Paul, how are you getting on?
I'm very well, thanks.
So talk us through this project. What is happening?
Yeah, I suppose it's kind of the brainchild of JP McManus, where he was looking at Limerick City Centre and looking at projects that could help as part of the regeneration of the city centre, and a tourist attraction was one of the ideas. And I suppose one thing led to another. It ended up becoming a kind of a rugby experience. So it's a very nice location in 4041 O'Connell Street. It's in the middle of the city centre. It's going to be a beautiful building designed by Neil McLaughlin Architects. The inside of the building then is curated by a company called Event Communications. And it's a, I suppose, a digital interactive rugby experience is what it's supposed to do, and it's what it's supposed to be. And it's, I suppose, maybe cementing rugby in the city centre. It's a very, I suppose, Limerick is a big sports mad city. Rugby is a big part of the city. Obviously, junior soccer is a big part of the city as well. Hurling, football, all sorts of sports. But this is the idea we went with, and it's been. Hopefully, it's going to be a fantastic project now, and a great attraction for people to the city centre, families, Irish tourists, international tourists, and I suppose it gives us a combination of things. You know, you have King John's Castle, you have Thomond Park, you have the Gaelic Grounds, you have the Hunt Museum, you have Bunratty Castle just outside the city as well. It gives a combination of things for a family to come to the city and to do over the space of a few days.
What will you be drawing from for this? Will it be mostly Munster? Will it be Ireland? Will it be international rugby?
No, it's international rugby. Yeah, it's not Ireland specific or Munster specific whatsoever. It's rugby from all over the world. The women's game, sevens, 15s. You know, the whole the story behind it is that there's kind of two stories that runs throughout the experience. It's the journey from grassroots to legendary status and everything that goes in between, from, you know, the training required, the preparation required, the backroom staff, the people involved in helping people play and enjoy the game. And then it goes through the five values of world rugby as well. And we use different characters to tell those stories. So, you know, on paper, it looks amazing. It looks spectacular. And hopefully we can deliver that.
The experience aspect of it, Paul, brings to mind like maybe something like the Storehouse or the Titanic experience in Belfast. Is that the type of, like, it's not just for a rugby nut, is that right?
Yeah. I suppose, look, I think any sports fan will enjoy it. I think even anyone that's into tech or anything like that will enjoy it as well. Yeah, and it's an experience. It's, as I said during the week, there won't be many artifacts in the experience. It's more about experiencing the sport through, I suppose, digital pieces and little galleries throughout the experience.
Yeah, and your role in it, are you chairman of the committee?
I'm chairman, yeah. There's a lot of people. I mean, Barry Hannon is probably the guy that works the most on it. He's our CEO. But I suppose we have a lot of people that we need to pick up the phone to. And we need, you know, past players. I mean, we've spoken to a whole host of past players and explained what the project is, and I've asked them, look, can we use your image in this, you know, and explain to them it's a not-for-profit setup. You know, most of the rugby players you speak to have heard of Thomond Park, they've been to Thomond Park, they've played in Thomond Park, or they've watched the game in Thomond Park, or they're eager to experience Thomond Park. So they know Limerick and they know Limerick's place in rugby. So everyone has been eager. Everyone we've spoken to, from Richie McCaw to, you know, Sean Fitzpatrick to Nigel Owens, all these characters, we picked up the phone to and said, this is what we're doing. They've all said, no problem, delighted to be involved. So we have a bit of a role in doing that, in chasing these people down, having the conversation with them and seeing if they get involved. So, and that's an important part of the project. Once we have those people involved, once we can use their images in it, we can create some pretty cool experiences for people.
It sounds class, Paul. So, not going for the artifacts means you won't be shelling out for Adrian Barry's All Blacks poster behind his shoulder then.
Yeah, well, that could have a place. There will be a place for little bits and pieces like that, you know, but I know he's such a big Munster fan, I don't know if he'd ever let it go.
It's this not-for-profit thing that would just do for me, Paul, to be honest with you.
Yeah, I'd better break the deal, would it?
I wouldn't be a deal breaker.
What is life on the rugby front like for you at the moment, Paul? Is it, do you get an off-season in your coaching capacity? Do you always need to be on, or how do things work for you at the moment?
Yeah, we took a bit of a break after the America game, because, you know, we've kids and stuff that want a holiday or need supervision under holiday. So, but mainly just watching games now and trying to follow what's happening and see what's happening in the world of rugby. You know, I mean, anything South Africa do with Razi and Jacques is always pretty innovative. It may not be, you know, it may not be incredibly attractive, but there's always sound logic behind a lot of what they're doing. So they're always well worth watching. And same with Warren Gatland, you know, his way of trying to counteract what South Africa are doing is pretty interesting to follow as well. So you're just trying to, I suppose, keep up with the trend and see if there's anything worth copying or copying, pasting and editing it, I suppose.
Is running out to the pitch in a bib as the Mayor Ishka one of those things you're going to be copying?
Well, you see, they're very reliant on that because Jack Nienaber is obviously a qualified physiotherapist. So, you know, he wasn't just a water boy when he was with Munster or with the Lions. He was able to do more than run water. The physiotherapists are allowed outside the technical area while the game is on. So, you know, when Munster were playing, I remember him and the Lions. I was over at the World Cup and South Africa. I was at the World Cup. He's actually, you know, when teams were doing attacking lineouts, he was actually standing opposite his team's defensive line, calling the plays that he felt that the opposition were going to do, you know, because he used to do incredible research in his role as a defensive coach. So I'd say they've become really reliant on having a strong coaching personality on the sideline. And they've managed to exploit the rules to, obviously Jacques isn't allowed to be there now, so they've managed to kind of exploit the rules to having Razi down there on the sideline.
It must be incredibly exciting going into a second test that these are the guys that are chasing the series rather than the other way around. Because as you say, there's something cunning about the pair of them. Even the sort of wry smile when they're doing press, it sort of feels like they know a lot more than they let on at all times.
Yeah, look, I suppose they're all being a little bit careful. They all have their messages. You know, they're all very conscious that they're speaking to their own players as much as they're speaking to the press, I think. I used to get annoyed with Warren Gatland. I think certainly in the earlier days he took a swipe off Declan Kidney, but you realize they're just playing a game. You know, even Razi this week with the Twitter stuff, and they're just playing a game. They're not I don't think it's bad sportsmanship or anything like that. They're playing a game. They're doing what they can to win. They're using their logic. It may not be the logic we all agree with, or it may be not be the logic we see, I suppose, but they're using their logic to do what they can to win.
I noticed when you were name-checking the coaches earlier on, you didn't name-check Jaakko Johan, who's obviously one of the key personalities in all of this thing. I have to admit, when I'm looking at it, I'm really enjoying the sort of back and forth of the exchanges between, it's not even really Razi versus Warren Gatland, it's like Razi versus the world sort of thing. What, as a coach, when you're looking at that stuff, what's your impressions of what's going on, or yeah, the intrigue of it? Is it a sign of pressure on Razi Erasmus, or what's your take on it?
I don't think it's a sign of pressure. I mean, I'd be speaking to people that have worked with him, and you know, most people are incredibly fond of him. They think that he's a brilliant people person, and you know, his players are his number one priority. So the people that are really close to him are big fans of his. I think then, when you look at some of the stuff that goes on during the week, you know, you'd be wondering, I suppose you'd be wondering about his character, but I think he just looks at the game a little bit differently to other people. He looks at every single thing about the game a little bit differently to other people. I mean, I don't think I don't think, you know, when even when you look at the GAA managers in the media and the build up to games here, no GAA coach here does any of that stuff, you know, engages in any of these hand grenades. They're always really careful, you know, even you
couple,
look at
couple of high profile exceptions, Paul, but yeah.
Have we had a couple of I just John Kiley the other week. I mean,
yeah,
you know, when they played Galway, he came out afterwards and apologized for some of the things he said. I think there's a real respectful attitude to it. We just don't really do it here. So when you see Razzie doing it or you see Gats doing it, I think it seems very strange to us in Ireland, but they just look at the game differently. And I think that's something I would have noticed from Gatland. Even going back to 2009, he does things differently. He looks at the game differently. He thinks about it differently. And I think the fun is in trying to figure out what he's thinking rather than trying to figure out exactly, you know, rather than trying to figure out the good and the bad of it. Mm.
Just on that, on the Warren Gatland aspect of it and all the chat about Marius Jonker in the previous week, was that just, I mean, maybe the proof was in the game on Saturday, but was that stuff just trying to get inside the, in your view, trying to get inside the ref's head or the TMO's head to, you know, and maybe there's a similar element with the Razzie stuff, but they're just trying to deliver a message that has everybody kind of second guessing themselves.
Yeah. There's a reason you don't have a local ref for the test matches. You know, it's unfair on the referee. There's no doubt the referee will be going out of his way to try and do a great job. But he's under unfair pressure. And the same applies to the TMO. So, you know, I totally understand Warren Gatland's misgivings. And I totally understand why he would bring it up in the media, because he wants to put that touch judge under pressure. Mm. And I thought last week when I heard that it was going to be a South African TMO, I thought it was actually going to be beneficial to the Lions, because, you know, no matter what he did, he was going to be under pressure. And I think they put him under in an unfair position, really, to be honest with you. So for sure, Gatland was trying to put him under pressure in what he did in the media and the build-up.
Are you confident that the Lions are going to back up their first week performance, given the changes that Gatland has made for this weekend?
I'd say they'll play the same way. I mean, when you talk about their first week performance, I mean, it was a flick of a coin, really, who won the game. I mean, one or two decisions go either way and the other team wins the game, and one set of coaching staff looks great. And that's the way the South African games have gone, even in 2019. That's the way those games went. The Welsh game in the World Cup, you know, when they drew with New Zealand in 2019, they want to give you back the ball, and then they want to put you under pressure and try force you to make mistakes, and then they want to exploit those mistakes and score with in one phase or two phases and no more than that. They're not looking to create anything per se, and the Lions have more or less done the same thing against them. I mean, when Wales played South Africa in the World Cup, they kicked the same number of times. I think maybe South Africa kicked the ball once more than them. They effectively played the exact same game back at them. And that's what the Lions did at the weekend again. They played their game straight back at them. And it essentially becomes a flick of a coin who'll win, you know, who'll get the little bounce of a ball or who will get the refereeing decision. You know, you got to give big credit to the Lions for scoring a maul try. I think, you know, I think that is a very, very difficult thing to do against South Africa. And I think, you know, you see that could have a lot to do with Dwayne Vermeulen not being in there as well. I think it's kind of an unseen thing that you don't realize he's missing. You want to see him carrying the ball, or you see him carrying the ball, you think he's a great player. You actually don't see a lot of what he does in terms of the South African maul or even the South African maul defense as well. So big credit to the Lions for scoring a maul try. But essentially, it's a little bit of a toss of the coin who wins the game, the way both of them are playing at the moment.
I remember on one of the previous tours you mentioning afterwards that you, was it Justin Tuprake or one of those players that had gone into great detail about how they prepare or some technique? There was something that you took that you were kind of, if I remember rightly, sort of almost surprised that he was as sharing as he was. With that mindset or with your coaching at and watching the game at the weekend, was there one player or move or theme that stood out for you in a way that you were like, yeah, we could actually, let's make a note of that. We could do that.
When you say we could do that, do you mean the Lions Ireland. Could do that Ireland. Or Ireland? Look, I think the high ball stuff is interesting. You know, I think certainly a few years ago, Ireland thrived on being excellent at chasing the high ball, being excellent at catching the high ball. And that's essentially where the Lions found a lot of, I suppose, found a bit of a foothold in the game was that high ball work. And I think Ireland are pretty good at that, you know, and we have been for a while. You know, it goes back a long time. I suppose it goes back to a bit of a, you know, the fact that we play in bad weather a little bit. It goes back to the GA a little bit, and it goes back to maybe Joe Schmidt in his earlier days putting a big emphasis on it for Ireland teams. So you'd see a lot of our wingers before training and after training, practicing high ball stuff. And because of that, there's a big body of work being built up. So I think it's a part of the game that we should never, I think we should never underestimate it. You know, all these things come into fashion and out of fashion. And sometimes the high ball stuff, teams get really good at defending it, like England have done in the past against us. And then it kind of falls off again and you can start having a crack at it again. So that's one of the things. I mean, I do think maul defence and maul attack and scrum, you know, you look at Tadhg Furlong and the job he did in the scrum at the weekend. You look at some of the big quality, big men that we have coming through. You know, those are places that you can really get a foothold into the game against teams. And the Lions did it well at the weekend. You know, you got to credit them for scoring a maul try. I know that it's probably a boring part of the game, but it's a very difficult thing to do at the moment. It's one of the reasons you see Exeter and Leinster and all these teams taking a quick tap from 5 metres out instead of going for the maul. It's become so difficult to score now. So you've got to give credit to the Lions for scoring that try.
Yeah, particularly against that South African team. Who's better under the high ball, Hugo Keenan or Simon Zeebo?
Oh, jeez, there's a question to ask a coach. I don't know. They're both very good at it. And it's great to have Simon Zeebo back. The more competition we have in all these positions, the better. You know, all these teams that have done in the World Cup, done well at the World Cup in the past, they've all had really deep squads. So when they've struggled with injuries, they've had quality players to come in. So it's great to have another quality fullback playing in Ireland.
One of the things that you mentioned there is about maybe learning from what the Lions are doing to a certain point. And I wondered, what was your reaction to Conor Murray temporarily being named British and Irish Lions captain? I think a lot of people were taken by surprise with that because he wasn't, it seemed, in the conversation for the Ireland captain role, let alone the Lions captain role going into this tour. Was it something that took you by surprise?
Yeah, probably did. I mean, I suppose it meant that maybe they didn't see Owen Farrell as a first choice out half, maybe, you know, because he would have been the obvious candidate, maybe. I think that Gats kind of thrives on doing the not obvious thing as well. I think if you name Owen Farrell as captain, you know what you're going to get with Owen Farrell. And even if he's not captain, he probably behaved the same way as well. I would say Gats has probably massive respect for Conor, and he's probably thinking by naming him captain he'll get a little bit more out of him. You know, I mean, Conor doesn't say a lot, but what he does say tends to be pretty accurate and on the mark, and it's probably the more of that you can get, the better. It probably means that Owen Farrell, you know, continues to behave the way he would always behave even if he was captain or not captain, but you get a little bit more out of Conor Murray. And then probably other guys around him kind of go, you know, they kind of feel, I would say, that, you know, they're on a level with Conor, and it probably brings a bit more out of them. And then maybe as well, what I was thinking is that the fact that Conor hasn't done it before, people feel, you know, I need to help this guy here. I need to make sure this experience is good for him, and it brings other people out of his shell. I mean, that's where I was kind of seeing where he may have come at it. I mean, you know, like Gats named Sam Warburton captain of Wales at 22. You know, he wouldn't have been a, you know, Sam would say it himself, he wouldn't have been a big leadership guy. He wouldn't have had a lot of opinions on what they should be doing or shouldn't be doing. But he grew into the role, and probably other people grew into the supporting role around him. And I would say that was the logic around the Connor selection. I'm not sure.
One more for me, Paul, just on the possibility of Donegal Ryan, it looks like potentially joining Ronan O'Gara at La Rochelle, another big name Irish second row getting into the coaching thing. But you've obviously spent a bit of time over there, and it'll be a different dynamic for him, obviously, given he's got one of the natives running the show. What's your thoughts on it? Like, he obviously seems like he might have the option to play on maybe in the Pro D2 or to get into the coaching thing. What would your advice be? Maybe he has called you, but what would your advice be if he picked up the phone?
I think the big thing is you need to know what you're going to stand for in what you're going to do, you know? So I don't know what his role is going to be. If his role is coaching the line out, he needs to figure out what he believes in and how he wants to coach it. Then he probably needs to figure out what they believe in, you know, what are their things that they want to keep as part of their game. Because, you know, in La Rochelle, they have a really interesting way of defending lineouts. We would have seen it against Leinster, that no other team does. That I'd say if you tried to copy it, you'd get it wrong because there's a lot of detail in it. So, And I would say the players are very, very attached to it because it's given them an awful lot of success. So he's going to have to know what he stands for, but he's going to have to know as well what they stand for and what they want to do. And he's going to be able to have to, you know, find what's in the middle with that. So, and then it's just about being clear and concise and consistent with the players. I think Rod seems to be... Rog and John O'Gibbs obviously were running the club really well there. It was a very happy camp. They seem to sign quality players. They sign the players that suit their system and their way of playing. So I don't think it's the same challenge it might be in other French clubs, you know. So it's a great place for him to start. And as well as that, you know, he has a real ally in Rog, you know, someone he can really discuss things and argue things and bounce things off, you know, because Rog has been on the journey. He went to Racing, probably found it tough at times. And then I suppose saw the light in the Crusaders, and now he's back in La Rochelle. He's a real big body of work, not the same exact same work as Donegal Ryan is going to be doing, but the exact same experience as Donegal Ryan is going to be having. So he'll be able to get great advice there. So I think it's a great place for him to start. And I think he'll really enjoy it.
Yeah, just a reminder that we have Paul O'Connell with us here on OTBAM because a €30 million state-of-the-art interactive rugby experience is set to open in the heart of Limerick City in autumn of next year. Paul, it sounds fantastic. It's a really exciting project. Best of luck with everything, and we'll chat to you again soon.
Okay, cheers, guys. Thanks for having me. OTB AM.
Paul O'Connell in conversation with myself and Adrian before we came on air this morning. Adrian, a great morning for you personally. I mean, the rowers and plenty of other things happening in your life.
Great morning, Owen. Yeah, I mean, I'm on with you on a Thursday morning, which in itself is such a unique occurrence. I'm sure that's what you're getting at. So, yes, absolutely amazing.
Any other news to bring the nation or anything like that?
Nothing too much. Just keeping it all on the lowdown and the lockdown on. Yeah.
Well, as you can hear, ladies and gentlemen, we have birthday boy Adrian Barry with us. Adrian, no better way to celebrate your birthday than watching a gold medal being won at the Olympic Games, I'm sure, and spending your morning with me.
I planned to, and I must after this, shut down my Facebook account. I don't use it at all, and it's responsible for nonsense like this, I'm assuming. But thank you, Owen. Yeah.
Set your Google Calendar reminders for the 29th of July every year from here on out. Right. Happy birthday, Adrian. What is your age? Because apparently
I'm
44. That's the appropriate 44.
44 today, Owen. So, I mean, I know that to your young age, you're like, oh my God, 44 is so old. And I suppose it is. You just kind of still feel as if you're, I mean, when you know when you were like a kid and you'd hear your parents, friends and your parents talking about, you know, I'm whatever age. And it still feels as if I'm sort of 24. That's sort of what it still kind of feels that way. No, thanks, Owen. I really appreciate you drawing attention to that. And we can move on now, I think.
You're welcome. Well, have a great day. All the four is 44, Adrian Barry. Nile O'Toole will have you rowing at the next Olympics if he had it his way from our chat earlier on. Will O'Callaghan, I think, is with us at 9 o'clock on the button. How are you, Will?
Yeah, not too bad, lads. If it makes Adrian feel any better, I'm 53, according to my COVID cert. So got a few years to go. Unfortunately, someone in the manual input at the COVID cert centre managed to hook a 8 into a 6. And I think if I'm going to travel, I'm probably going to have to endure the 7 hours on the phone that some people have been doing over the last week. So I've been trying to put it off for quite a while because friends have had bad experiences kind of waiting on hold. But then you know, we're happily looked after that. So next time I look to get out of the country, I'm going to have to get that COVID are changed, or they're going to think I'm the youngest 53-year-old on the plane.
Embrace it is what I say, Will. I presume there's only one place you're going to start with us this morning.
Yeah, look, rowers Paula Donovan and Fintan McCarthy crowned Olympic champions in Tokyo. The Skibbereen duo rowing home to gold in a thrilling final in the lightweight men's double sculls. They finished strongly to pip Germany in the end, lads. A time of 6 minutes and 6 seconds. Not quite as quick as their semi-final where they set a world's best yesterday, but enough to finish in the gold medal position and to land Ireland's second medal of the games after the bronze for the women's four yesterday. And it's the first gold for Ireland at the Olympics since London 2012 with Katie Taylor. The golf is ongoing because it was delayed for almost 2 hours because of a weather delay. There was lightning and strong winds earlier. Rory McIlroy is 2 under par. He's got 3 holes left to play. Shane Lowry is level par through 14 holes, while Austria's Sepp Straka has a 2-shot clubhouse lead. Perhaps not the expected player to be in the gold medal position, but he's at 8 under par after signing for a 63. Annalise Murphy, silver medalist back in 2016, has boosted her chances of qualifying for the medal race in sailing's laser radial. The Dubliner was second in race 8 this morning after winning race 7, and she's up to 14th place with 2 more qualifier races still to be completed tomorrow. It's a big jump up for her because she was in the mid-20s after 2 days of competition. Robert Dixon and Sean Waddilove say they're feeling pretty good at the midway point of the 49er event. They're not far outside the medal places currently. 2nd and 6th place for them this morning in their 2 races, and they're up to 7th place overall ahead of the final set of races tomorrow. Derek Burnett finished in 26th position in the trap men's qualification in shooting, didn't advance to the final, but a remarkable achievement for the Longford man who was competing in his 5th Olympics. No joy in the judo for Ben Fletcher. He was knocked out in the first round of the men's 100 kilograms. Swimmer Shane Ryan is the last Irish person in action today. He's in the 100 metres butterfly heats at around midday Irish time on.
How did you react to the gold medal earlier on, Will? Was it a dancing around the living room sort of job?
It was a should I now go for 2 hours sleep before I get back up for the breakfast shift kind of reaction. And I decided to stay up and watch Sunita Pushpour afterwards. And like I was listening to you guys chanting to Nile O'Toole earlier on. It's just such a disappointment that you've got an athlete who competes so well in what was a 5-year cycle ahead of these Olympic Games, you know, winning a European gold, winning the world championship twice. And we heap expectation onto our athletes sometimes, and we just expect them to go and, you know, breeze through to a medal. Not everyone has maybe the coolness and the assuredness that we saw from McCarthy and O'Donovan. And unfortunately for Sunita, she wasn't happy with her first row last weekend, was very unhappy after finishing up in 5th place in her semi-final today, doesn't progress to the medal race. And, you know, given it was probably her last chance to win an Olympic medal, unless she's creative, like Niall had suggested, and goes into a bigger boat next time round, It's a big pity for someone that we had heaped a lot of expectation onto. And then I said, look, I'll keep on watching through. I'll try and watch some of the golf. And then unfortunately, the minute I flicked the golf on, the lightning hits and the 2 Irish players had to go into the clubhouse for what was a pretty lengthy break. They're a long way back as things stand. Rory McIlroy, 6 shots off the lead. Lowry, 8 shots off the lead. But all 60 players are pretty tightly bunched after the first round. And you would imagine there's still plenty of time for the guys to catch up ground there. We had some other news as well overnight. The American pole pole vault world champion Sam Kendricks has had to pull out of Tokyo 2020 after testing positive for COVID-19. He's one of three athletes who are now among 24 new cases which are connected with the Games. Multiple members of the Australian athletics team, not ideal ahead of their heats this weekend, are now isolating after being identified as close contacts. And Simone Biles was also on Twitter today, lads. The US gymnastics superstar says there's more than her sporting achievements in terms of ranking her as a person after she confirmed that she's out of today's women's all-around final. Writing on Twitter, she said she's come to that realisation after the outpouring of love and support that she's enjoyed over the last couple of days.
You are very sleep-deprived, as you've told us there, Will. So are you ready for the start of the athletics tomorrow morning?
Yeah, I really am. I mean, like, in some ways, for me, the Olympics really gets going when the track and field starts. Like, I'm a bit of a traditionalist in that regard. Like, when it comes to the sleep deprivation, when I saw Adrian on the show at 7:30 this morning, my first thought was, did I forget to put my quick picks in yesterday? I actually assumed it was Friday when I saw him on. I was like, did I just go through the entire day of Thursday and not realise this? So, yeah, no, I am massively looking forward to it. I think swimming is usually my favourite event on week one. And then you very much focus on track and field on week two. But we've been blessed with some of the sports that we've watched. Like, I was glued to Nat Wen yesterday in his badminton match against Wang. And, like, he was very, very unlucky given how well he played in the second set that he just faded out in the third set. But what a prospect he is for the Tokyo Games in 3 years' time. He's going to be, I think, 24 at that stage when they come round. Kind of scary when you hear things like he grew up watching the Avengers movies. That'll make you feel all the age of 44 or 53. But going to be great to see him potentially fighting it out for a medal. I think he's playing his club badminton in Denmark now at this stage. So he's going to get some experience on the continent. Didn't get to play a huge amount of warm-up ahead of these games. But even chatting to all my mates who probably hated badminton in school, and particularly the shuttlecock getting lost maybe up in those big overhead lights in the gym, getting to see badminton played particularly well yesterday was a real thrill. Like, the Olympics are great. Like, even if you don't like a particular event, if you're watching Eurosport particularly, you can just go to one of the other channels and find something that interests you.
Yeah, he certainly has been the one that I think everybody wanted to win more than anybody else over the last couple of days, and it was such a tight encounter. A little bit of experience in his opponent as well yesterday, going down injured, I felt. Like, one of the big themes from Nat Wen has been the Stephen Cluxton influence, of course. The two of them set up the badminton club in St. David's and Artane. And by all accounts, Cluxton is an amazing badminton player himself.
Yeah, so the commentator was saying yesterday that I'd like to see it. Like, maybe Stephen Cluxton has a little bit more time in his hands now. If he's not going to be playing intercounty football, maybe he can push on and try and get on the Irish badminton team alongside his prodigy in Nat Wen. But great to see, you know, multi-skill within athletes, and also the mentoring from Stephen Cluxton, you know, to get Nat Wen to set up the badminton club in the school. So I'm sure there's loads who've been inspired by watching, you know, a former schoolmate of theirs going to the Olympic Games and performing as well as he did. And I think we're all going to be keeping an eye on that kid over the next 3 years.
You're with us as well tomorrow, Will?
I am, yeah. I'll actually get the quick picks in tomorrow. Nice again, one. I say there was just such a worry this morning. I was like, did Owen not WhatsApp me with the...
I have a feeling you did very well last weekend, Will. It's concerning me greatly over the last few days.
Well, we will...
I think I had one that was like the correct score, which is very helpful under the new scoring system. With the exception of, again, I backed against... I think I backed against Waterford again, and I need to stop doing that.
We all did.
Obviously, we need to stop.
Galway got knocked out. Galway are costing me a lot of points this year. I thought they were going to have a better year than they were. But
the good thing from here on out, Will, with, in terms of predict, well, not for this year, but for next year, predicting Galway, is you can just go with your instinct and assume that they no longer can just turn it on when they need to.
Yeah, like, it's a massive,
great man.
Yeah, like, massive rebuilds, as Skell was saying earlier on. Yeah. Like, and I'm sure they would have hoped, from a Galway management point of view, that they would keep Joe Canning around to probably ease that transition a bit.
Yeah.
Like, you look at the team now, and there's a lot of the players from the 27 team who are now starting to just kind of go on a downward slope. And, like, Canning, further out the pitch, it's funny. Like, there was never any right place to hurl Joe Canning. Like, at different stages when he was breaking through, he was like a half forward, then he drifted out into midfield. People thought he was a better playmaker sometimes than a finisher. The fact he could get a more ball out the field potentially improved his game. Then he had a couple of seasons where he was just like a lethal full forward. And watching the videos, particularly his two goals against Kilkenny back in 2012, were just remarkable. And then in 2017, he took on the, you know, I am the best player on the pitch and I'm going to play all over the place. And now I think there was still a role for Joe Canning to be had, either in the half forward line or maybe in a more withdrawn role. And if I'm the Galway management, whoever's in charge for next year, I'm calling Joe Canning and I'm trying to get him back in
for sure. And we will have those quick picks tomorrow morning. Will, great stuff.
Cheers, lads.
And we'll be back bringing us up to speed on everything that's happening tomorrow morning, because tomorrow is one of those mornings. I think it was probably, was it yesterday morning or Tuesday? I'm kind of losing track of the days, that was just packed with Irish events. And as we mentioned, the track and field is officially here tomorrow morning, so there's plenty happening. We're going to have, obviously, the golf going from early in the morning, hopefully, if the weather holds up. We'll have Sheafa Cleary-Butner in the women's 800 metres. We'll also have Nadia Power in the 800 metres. We'll have Louise Shanahan in round one of the same event. And then we'll have Tom Barr in his 400 metre hurdles, which is just going to be a cracking event to watch, even without the Irish interest there. Just some of the best athletes in the world going into 400 metre hurdles. You've got the Irish women's hockey team back in action. You've got Annalise Murphy chasing down a spot in the medal event in her sailing tomorrow. You've got Aidan Walsh boxing, you've got Kelly Harrington boxing, and that only brings you up till about 10 past 5 in the morning. So that is a massive slate of events for Will O'Callaghan to get stuck into us with us tomorrow morning here on OTBAM, and we'll have reaction as well. We do want to focus on something outside of the Olympic Games though, and Enda Coll is with us to talk about Celtic. Enda, good morning to you.
Hey lads, how's it going? Happy birthday, Adrian.
Thank you, Enda.
Midtjylland, we would have thought that this would have been a pretty sticky tie for Celtic anyway, so how badly are people taking this?
How badly are people taking it? People are already, you know, crossing off this season as a failure already, Owen, so it wasn't a good result for Celtic. I think, look, a lot of people thought going into this game it was going to lead to a defeat anyway, so that sort of softens the blow a little bit. But again, if you're looking at a team like Midtjylland, who have only been in existence since 1999, a team like Celtic should be beating them. A team like Celtic should be beating a Danish side to get into the third round qualifiers of the Champions League. So ultimately disappointing, not surprising, giving the build up to the game, giving the preparations.
Is it more to do with the fact that this is just, what is it, the fourth consecutive year that they haven't made the Champions League group stage? Is it more the accumulation of things, or are people genuinely getting wound up with the fact that this is a club that's 21 years or 22 years of age? Like, does that really matter? Like, this is the club that's actually made quite big strides over the last little while, and Celtic obviously have had a bad season last year.
Yeah, well, it is an accumulation. It's the accumulation over a number of years now. And if you look at this team, look at FC Midtjylland and the tie in general, they're the antithesis of what Celtic are trying to do. They are a well-organized club who have sorted out their scouting. They've got a good owner in place that is progressive and knows what it takes to succeed in the modern game. And then Celtic have Dermot Desmond in charge, who, you know, they were supposed to start this rebuild as of last year. So far, they have a manager. They've lost their chief scout. They've lost their CEO. They've got a new CEO coming in. So the rebuild has not even gotten off the ground yet. So it's a long way coming. Celtic, you know, if you look at the last 4 years, so it's 4 years since Celtic have gotten to the Champions League. And over the last 5 years, since 2015, Celtic have gotten beat in the Champions League qualifiers by Malmo, by AAK Athens, by Cluj, by Ferencváros, and now by Midtjylland. So they are sides you would expect a club like Celtic to beat. They're sides that you would expect Celtic to get through pretty handily, and they were well beaten by pretty much all those sides. So the problem is the preparation going into this game. So obviously Celtic had this horrendous season. Lee Lennon was, I want to say sacked, but he wasn't even sacked. He stepped down in February. Celtic wasted 4 months chasing Eddie Howe only to be let down. They have only had one player that they've brought into the club that was registered for this game, despite knowing this game was happening back way at the start of last season. So they were incredibly unprepared going into this game. New manager coming in 5 weeks before a Champions League qualifier is just not where Celtic want to be as a club.
So listen, sorry, just in terms of, sorry, just one more. In terms of the specifics of last night then, is there any particular individual? Are you looking at the sideline, or where is most of your anger or your disappointment going?
No, I definitely wouldn't blame it on Ange Postecoglou, the new manager. If anything, I give him huge credit because, I mean, if you look at the size last night, Celtic go into that game. If you look at the back four in its infancy, it's basically you've got Anthony Ralston, who's 22 years old. He's played two games over the last 2 years. We'll get back to him and the reason he's playing. Stephen Welsh, 21 years old, broke into the side last year. Dean Murray playing centre half, 18 years old. This was only one of his first senior games. He came on against Midtjylland last week when Nir Beaton got sent off. And then Greg Taylor, who was the replacement for Kieran Tierney's replacement, volleyball and goalie, who obviously has no future at the club given what happened last year. So to get even to this stage where Celtic were competitive in this game, competitive in the leg, and led the leg twice, led in the first leg, led in the second leg, only conceded three shots against Michelin, three of those ended up being goals. The job that Postecoglou has done in 5 weeks to transform this club into a competitive team has actually been quite impressive. Where the blame would fall is the lack of urgency within the board. Like I said, Neil Lennon stepped down in February. They chased Eddie Howe for 4 months and were let down. Then they got Ange Postecoglou in. Recruitment-wise, like I said, Anthony Ralston playing right back. He was never going to be good enough for the club. He wasn't good enough under three previous regimes. He's not going to be good enough now. Celtic sold their leading right back in January, Jeremy Frimpong. He went to Bayer Leverkusen. They brought in John Joe Kenny on loan. They knew since January they needed a right back. They're only now getting that right back in. Aurelio Buta is coming in from Royal Antwerp from Belgium. So he's only coming in now. And the rebuild that they were talking about at the start of the season, it was supposed to happen when, you know, the 10 in a row came. It hasn't happened. Dermot Desmond is still leading things by all accounts. He's still popping his nose in where it's not wanted. Peter Lawwell has left. Dominic Mackay came in. He's, you know, he's only starting his role, so you give him a bit of credit. But, you know, Celtic were supposed to modernise the club. A director of football was supposed to come in. That didn't happen. A lead scout was supposed to come in. That didn't happen. Ange Postecoglou comes in. He still doesn't have his own proper coaching staff. He's still working with John Kennedy and Strachan, who were Neil Lennon's, not even Neil Lennon's choice. They were Dermot Desmond's choice. So you're talking about this rebuild, and so far the rebuild is Ange Postecoglou. One person coming in, he is not going to transform Celtic to what they want it to be.
I was looking at some of the quotes after the game last night, and I haven't done a good enough job of convincing people that we needed to bring people in, which is the thing that you're touching on there. It struck me as maybe a slightly odd comment, but like you mentioned about the issues in defence and the most experienced defender last night being 23 years of age. But the result last night possibly is the best thing maybe to happen to Celtic in terms of his ability to convince the owners that this needs to change rapidly in terms of turning the season around.
I would love if you were correct. I would love if that was. I mean, it's not as if Celtic aren't bringing in players, right? So last season they brought in, I think it was 6 signings. It was just that the signings don't really seem to make sense. And you know, Celtic know they're going to be in this Champions League qualifier. They've been in it for years now. They know they have to get the business done in time for this qualifier. And like I said, Lil Abada, who came in from an Israeli side, he's the only player that Celtic signed this year that was registered in time for this game. They've already made a couple of signings. And, you know, some people might be able to say, they might throw back in your face that, you know, they didn't know who their manager was. They didn't want to bring in players who he didn't want to work with when he got there. But that's actually not the case, because Celtic are still working off an old scouting list, it seems. So Liam Shaw, who's come in, Ozai Urukide, they both come in from Sheffield Wednesday. They were scouted last year. They were on the old scouting list. So, I mean, if they were coming in anyway, get them in early for this fixture. Lil Abada, like I said, he's on the old scouting list. Why was he not in before this as well? And then there's a couple of players that you can point to. Furkashi, who's coming in from, he's coming from Asia. He seems to be the only signing that is Ange Postecoglou's signing. And I mentioned Dermot Desmond sticking his nose in where he's not wanted. A lot of people in the club and a lot of well-sourced people are saying that Dermot Desmond is involved in the day-to-day football action. That's not how you want your lead shareholder to be acting. You want him involved in the business side. You don't want him involved in the football. And if you look at the list of signings that he is he's credited with, it's not a great list. And he's currently being credited with another guy who's supposed to be coming into the team, Joe Hart. Joe Hart is due to join Celtic in the next couple of days. And I don't know if you saw my screenshot. The way that Ange Postecoglou plays football, the keeper essentially plays as a third defender. You know, he at points, Scott Bain was playing almost in the center circle of the midfield, working like he gets the ball first and he starts attack. Joe Hart was, you know, I don't know what Pep, you know, Pep wanted Claudio Bravo, who was dropping balls into the net, and he was still favouring him over Joe Hart because of how bad he was at football. So if Joe Hart is brought in as a replacement keeper, then that shows you that it's not Ange Postecoglou making the decisions in terms of transfers. It's someone else who doesn't know what they're doing. So that's the issue with recruitment. It's a mixture of is the manager really the one making the decisions here? And it doesn't seem like he is.
Very quickly, and suddenly a 25-point gap to Rangers might be an achievement this season from the picture you're painting.
Yeah, well, see, here's the thing about Scottish football is that, especially in the last couple of years, it can go horribly wrong. You still finish second. So what Ange Postecoglou needs to do is finish less second than Neil Lennon did last year. He needs to just narrow that gap a little bit. I mean, if you beat Rangers once or twice, then you're, you know, practically potentially on your way to a league title. So it's not a disaster just yet. But I think a lot of Celtic fans will still judge themselves, regardless of how often they get to Europe or not in modern times, as a European team. And Celtic need to start acting like a European team. I've been saying it for years now that, you know, Celtic have built for the domestic success. I think that was Peter Lawwell's legacy, is he's had so much domestic success, but so much failure in Europe. And if Celtic built for Europe, they would ultimately be successful domestically. So I don't get the idea of putting domestic football first. You put European football first if you're a team like Celtic that want to develop on the world stage and develop talent that you're going to sell for a lot of money. Because ultimately, these clubs are businesses. And if you're playing in Europe, if you're playing consistently in Europe, that's a marketplace for your best players. So it's going to ultimately lead to further you know, lack of funds. They're not going to have the same amount of money to challenge in Europe or to challenge for transfers as they did previously. And I mean, it's 40 million euro down the drain now that Celtic don't get because they don't get to the Champions League. So ultimately, it's going to hurt the business, and that's where Celtic will really start to fall back.
All right, Enda, good stuff this morning. Thanks a million for that.
Cheers, lads.
Enda Call there on the line, giving his take on Celtic's exit for the fourth consecutive year. They will not be in the Champions League. So it is 9:21 on this Thursday morning. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Now, just to let you know, the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy is now available first on the OTB Sports app every week. Get the hop on everyone else by turning on push notifications on your OTB Sports app now. And once the pod drops on the app first every Tuesday, we will let you know. From Wednesday, the podcast will be available everywhere else. Just search for the Football Pod with Paddy and Andy and click subscribe. Episode 12 is available to listen to right now across all platforms, and both Andy and Paddy fear that Kildare may end up on the end of a Dublin backlash this Sunday.
But we used Westmeath as an example against Cork last week, when McCartan went through and he had two goal chances and missed the two of them. Mm. And we pointed that as an element where Cork could be in a bit of trouble here against Kerry. Westmeath scored 18 points on Kildare. Like, you two boys were at the game. 18 points, missed a lot of chances.
They're not a goal chance.
Oh,
yeah, scored two.
Lads, glorious goal chances.
The stuff that Dublin are listening to over the next couple of weeks, like, Paddy's definitive there on Tyrone. I think Tyrone will win by slight margins, but Paddy is going strong on them. I'm going strong on Dublin. I think this is going
so
to
be... So am I, by the way.
I think this is going to be... Like, Dublin will be a bit wound up. Dangerous.
They think they're angry.
Dangerous when they're wound up. You know, and they are, and people are saying, oh, they're fallible. And if you look at the stats about it, Mayo had a bad quarter, 20 minutes yesterday. Kerry had a bad 15 minutes against Cork. Dublin had a bad 15 minutes against Meath, and it's nearly like the world is shutting down. Like, they've created that highest standards for themselves. I pity Kildare. I go back to Jack O'Connor's interview after the Westmeath game, and Jack O'Connor's a fighter, and he's he's got them to Division One. He has them in a Leinster final. No matter how this result goes on Sunday, but his interview after the game was, we're not just going up to make up the numbers, but he also put in that we've met Division One and we've met the Leinster final.
He was ticking that box just in case.
He that rings in my ears. And I'm not saying he is definitely not going up to make up the numbers. We all know Jack O'Connor. We've seen him now for the guts of 20 years. He is a winner at all costs. But this game, lads, it's Dublin's chance to really make a statement. for the last 5 years, particularly last year, we've been saying Dublin haven't got a challenge in Leinster. Oh, it's going to come against them and they go to a semi-final and final. They've now got a challenge in Leinster.
Yeah.
But Sunday, I don't know, Paddy, you probably know more about the injuries. I think you're going to see every player that's available to Dublin on the field on Sunday. And I think you're going to... And they're going to put down a statement. And if Owen Doyle, that's why I kind of grimaced when I heard that he was in. If he's out, I didn't actually realise that. If he's out, poor lads, I'm telling you. Because when you're, sorry, no, I'm harping on it. But if when you're playing against Dublin and they're holding the ball for so long, the discipline you need in your defending is unbelievable. And nobody's doubting what Kildare have up front. There's two Flynns.
Jimmy Highland.
Yeah. Jimmy Highland, Neil Flynn, and Danny Flynn.
Yeah, he bet Mayo against in the 20s by himself a couple of years ago. Like top quality players, but their discipline against Dublin needs to be spot on for 75 seconds.
But that's Dublin just wait for someone to switch off. Yeah, that's the thing.
The Joes music last week.
If you keep it long enough, someone is going to switch off.
They're going to break the line and away they go. And lads, that is going to happen on Sunday. It is going to happen. And I think Kildare are going to get a bit of a trimming on Sunday.
There you heard it. Dublin back with a bang this Sunday afternoon in the Leinster final. It's the football pod there with Paddy and Andy and Tommy. When are we going to start referring it to the Paddy and Andy and Tommy pod is what I want to know, because it's three of them there, but that's just the way things go, I guess. It is available on the OTB Sports app first every week, so make sure you download the OTB Sports app and you'll get it there first. You'll have literally a podcast reacting to the previous weekend's football, but you'll get it everywhere else as the week goes on, and it's available everywhere now, which will build up nicely to the Ulster and Leinster finals this weekend. We are turning our attention now to whatever else might be on your agenda this week. If you're a little bit sick of the Olympics and you're sick of the GAA and you just want something else, what else is on television? Sue Murphy, you're here with us. How are you?
Hi. Nobody's sick of the Olympics. They don't need me for this lot at all at the moment, do they? Well, we just won gold.
Well, I mean, once you get to midday, the Olympics do stop, in fairness, Sue. So
and then everyone comes to bed.
If you're too lazy to, I don't know, go for a walk or have lunch, there are other things available to you. So
is this just for you, Owen? I'm just doing these TVs for you, is it?
Thank you very much. Yeah, exactly. But at least I'm happy. So what is new this week?
I think the big release going into cinemas, and it'll be going on to Disney Premiere, is Jungle Cruise. This was made about 2 years ago, so it's good to finally get it. It kind of feels like I don't know if you saw The Mummy about 10 or 15 years back, but it kind of feels like a follow-up to that. I don't know if I really need to tell you the plot. They're basically looking for a tree that has healing powers. Its petals have healing powers. And Lily is played by Emily Blunt, who goes down the Amazon. She hires The Rock, who plays Frank, to go down the Amazon to find this tree.
I've seen the trailer for this about 40 times because the ad comes up on the RTE player all the time. So I've started recording on in my box at home so that I don't have to watch the Olympics on RTE player overnight. But this ad is on every single time. So I'm very familiar with this.
They're really pushing it. I think it's because there's so few massive releases that are going into the cinema at the moment, but this is a huge release, obviously. And the reason I don't need to tell you about the plot is because it's The Rock being The Rock on a boat in the Amazon, and that's kind of all you need to know. And that's grand. I think The Rock is fine with just being The Rock and earning a lot of money, like top earner in Hollywood, and just making these kind of films. It's fun. There's a lot of really good over and back between him and Emily Blunt. They actually work quite well together. I'm always surprised at Emily Blunt because I think she's a much better actress than some of the roles she picks. And Jungle Cruise kind of feels like something that's a little bit beneath her. But and the other problem is it's about 2 hours and 10 minutes long, I think, is the total runtime. That's including credits. So it's about 2 hours long. And I just can't understand why they make kids' films that are this long with complicated plots. You're not going to keep a child in front of a film for 2 hours. Mm. And from people I've heard who have seen it, some kids just wandered off after 45, 50 minutes. It takes a while to get into it. But I did, once I got into it, and there was a lot of action scenes and there was The Rock being The Rock, it was fun. It's a lot of fun. But it just takes a while to get going.
What is How to Be a Tyrant?
Oh, I'm really enjoying this. This is on Netflix. I don't know if you can say you're really enjoying it because it's basically teaching you how to be a fascist dictator.
Okay.
so it's kind of like the playbook for being a dictator. And it's over 6 episodes, and it used different examples through history of the best dictators and how they managed to achieve what they achieved. So it starts with Hitler. It looks amazing. Do you know what I like about the best is it looks great and it's accessible, because I think with history documentaries, you know, sometimes you watch a World War II documentary, it's heavy going. It could be hard to take in all the information. You know, various things happen in various areas around Europe. This is just makes it very accessible for people to understand Hitler's rise to power. And it's done in a really clever way. The only problem I think is it can be a little bit tone deaf. Like one of the things it says is, oh, you know, yeah, you're going to have to make some really bad, like hard decisions. And you're like, yeah, but that hard decision was killing 6 million people. It's not like it's just a bad decision you made in the morning. It's really horrible. So it's just a big glib in parts. But I actually really liked the way they presented it, because they like, it's a book. The book opens up and a chapter would be like, form your squad, find your crew, make sure you have a message. What's your brand? And all of the, like, it just looks incredible. It's like a marketing meeting that's done really, really well. But it's just like Hussein is the second one, but just a little bit tone deaf, if you know what I mean.
Right. I'm all for the ridiculously dense World War II documentaries, to be honest with you. I think, like, dumbing it down is just not a good thing to do. Like, is the World at War on Netflix, the Laurence Olivier narrated one? I remember watching it back.
That's hard going, though.
That's brilliant. It's absolutely brilliant.
It's brilliant, but it should be hard going. It should be done.
I would watch the Saddam episode of that. That sounds like that sounds like it could be new, but like, I mean, Hitler's been done a lot, and it's like, here's a new way of doing it. It's just my opinion on it. Right, next up is Movies That Made Us.
I just put this in because, you know what, it's actually a really nice way to spend 40 minutes. So this is the second series of this. The Toys That Made Us was the first season, the first series that these guys did, and then they moved on to this. So they've kind of gone back to films that you would rewatch or you grew up with, Back to the Future, Jurassic Park, Pretty Woman. They kind of get some of the crew together, some of the cast, they get them to tell stories about the film, they give highlights. I don't think there's a massive amount they're telling you that you won't already know if you're a fan of the film. Like, if you're a fan of Back to the Future, you're probably going to know a lot of the information that's in it. But at the same time, it's just a lovely way to spend 40 minutes with Michael J. Fox and some great characters like Doc Brown, and how they managed to, like, Michael J. Fox wasn't in the first 6 weeks of filming of that film. So it's just nice. It's like, if you want to just tune out for a while and watch something that you grew up with, like, I haven't got to the Jurassic Park one yet, but I can't wait to watch it. Those kind of things are just nice TV.
There is a line on my document here that says, oh my Jesus, can we do Love is Blind? So why are we talking about Love is Blind this week, Sue?
It's not even like Love is Blind, though, as far as I'm, it's like the after
the altar. So I was looking around yesterday to see picks, because at the moment there aren't a lot of massive new picks that are coming out, and top of the Netflix thing was Love is Blind After the Altar. Now, I don't know if you guys watched Love is Blind, but it was this amazing concept. No. Where they put people through hell and they basically put them in rooms where they couldn't see each other, but they had to make a connection. And once they made the connection, they got married. So you proposed to the other person in the room without ever seeing them. First time you saw them was on their wedding day. And this is 2 years later. So it's after the altar to see how they got on. Like, to be honest, a lot of it is fluff. Like, there's just not a lot they're getting out of it. But two of the couples are still together after 2 years, which I find absolutely unbelievable. And it's just, there's a couple of dramatic bits in it that they hang the entire episode around. So it's not as good as the series was, but it's just, if you want to do a catch up, I don't think they do enough catch ups and things, actually. Like, if you're watching Love Island, you're kind of like, who's with who now or what's going on? They don't really go back to them that much as this kind of thing. But it's just, it's just the dramatic bit with Jessica.
Why do they need to get married too? Like, why can't they just, like, are they giving them 100 grand or something? Like,
I'd say they're paying them well enough for this, because one of the girls in particular, Jessica, her whole life fell apart after this, and she literally stood a guy up at the altar and ran out of the chapel. It was it's got really dramatic television.
I mean, it's fair enough. you met the guy, like.
Well, that was her realization. She was like, I don't think this is for me. Actually, I think I've been in the wrong bubble. But it's just. It's just mental TV, and I think it's just the next step. They're always just trying to find something that people haven't seen before. So, like, oh, we've got plenty of people that have got together. What we do now? Oh, do you know what? We're getting, like, married at first sight. It's just,
But Mario
you're messing with people's emotions. I know.
I won't hear a bad word about Mario first.
I wasn't giving out about it.
We do not have time for your Love Island update. So what we're going to do next week is we're going to put Love Island to the very top of the running order and update that next week. So keep your hot takes for that. Sue Murphy, great stuff. Appreciate
Thanks a million.
Okay,
thanks.
So this morning, before 10 o'clock, we're bringing you Ronan O'Gara and the Lions ahead of the second test this Saturday, which is live across Off the Ball with thanks to Vodafone, lead partner of the British and Irish Lions. First, though, we're hearing from Ross Byrne and Harry Byrne, who are in the midst of a brilliant charity initiative. Okay, spearheaded by Leinster rugby players, brothers and competitors Harry and Ross Byrne. They're taking teams on a virtual run from the 2nd to the 16th of August from Dublin to Rome, covering the host cities of the Six Nations Championship. On registration, participants will automatically be assigned to Team Ross or Team Harry, with Ross and Harry acting as team captains. Each team will work towards the collective goals of running from the Aviva to the Stadio Olimpico in Rome and back, covering the host stadiums of the Six Nations, which is 4,364.8 kilometres, with the team that has clocked up the most kilometres by August 16th winning the race. Runners and walkers of all ages and abilities are invited to take part, and you can register now to clock your miles for Dublin Simon's Run at Home with Team Harry and Team Ross. And if you don't have time to run, you can buy some kilometres for your favourite team in the Dublin Simon Run at Home. Visit dubsimon.ie/run at home, and it is supported by Deutsche Bank. Harry, Ross, how are you getting on?
All good, thanks. Yeah, very well. Yourself?
Good. So who has got the upper hand so far?
It's pretty even at the moment, I think, in terms of sign-ups.
how have you found being involved in the campaign so far, Harry?
It's been brilliant so far, yeah. It's been very interesting just to see, I suppose, get a little bit of an insight into what the Simon community does. Only kind of getting a little taster of how important a cause it actually really is.
What are you learning?
Well, just how many people they help, really, in something that's so close to home, really. Homelessness, particularly in Dublin, is, and kind of in the surrounding areas in Leinster, is a massive issue, really. And they do massive work to help so many people. So I'm really excited to be on board in this campaign to help raise funds for that very important work.
Are you starting to, I guess, become aware of the real social role of sports people and sports people of note in this country?
I suppose so, yeah. It's massively important, I suppose, if anyone in any kind of, I don't know what you call it, whether it's a position of in any way privilege or you're on some sort of platform, it's definitely important to try help, particularly issues that are close to home.
Ross, I know you've been helping with Dublin Simon for quite some time. Have you learned anything new over the last little while? Has this campaign, I guess, further opened your eyes at all?
I suppose probably just with COVID, I mean, how much charities have probably been affected, really, in terms of, obviously, there's maybe a couple of times a year they'd have massive fundraising campaigns. And I suppose with all the restrictions in at the moment, it's very difficult for charities to actually put those campaigns, or those campaigns allowed to happen, I suppose. So it's very difficult for them to raise money to help them. So I suppose doing a virtual race like this hopefully can go a long way in helping the Dublin Simon community, because I suppose the money that they are raising is so important. And as Harry was saying, it is an issue that's very close to home.
And it's one of these situations as well where the funds raised will directly help the people in need.
Exactly, yeah. I suppose even the numbers of homeless are quite staggering a little bit in Dublin at the moment, or the amount of people in emergency accommodation it's up over 5,000, and that's not even including people who are sleeping rough. And the number came down a little bit last year, but because of the pandemic, it's gone up again slightly. So, and that's again due to, I suppose, Simon community not being able to raise as much money as possible. So I suppose we just encourage people to try and get involved in the virtual race to run at home. I mean, it's a bit of fun, it's a bit of activity. So it's for people of all abilities, walkers, runners, joggers, whatever you want. If you run 1K or 10K, hopefully you can donate a little bit of money and it'll go a long way.
And to get to perform for Team Ross as well, which is the most important thing, which you forgot to
exactly,
mention.
Exactly, that is the most important thing.
I'm pushing the back door system with the €10 per kilometre, so get on that.
Great. So, and have you been out and about with Dublin Simon Ross down through the years? Have you seen directly the sort of work they do?
Yeah, obviously before the previous years I've done it when COVID wasn't about. Even doing different stuff with them, you'd be able to see, I suppose, the direct work they do, and I suppose even the amount of people that are affected. So it is a big eye opener. And even, I suppose, in Leinster and Ireland, they've done work over the years with different homeless charities. So you do really get to see how much good work they do.
Yeah, and as you pointed out there, it's unbelievably important at the moment as well that people continue to try and give as much as they can. The website, just to reiterate it, is dubsimon.ie/runathome, and there are a multitude of reasons why you should sign up. Ross, have you been paying close attention to the British and Irish lines over the first weekend, the first proper weekend?
Yeah, I watched the game over the weekend. It was an interesting one. It was a bit of an arm wrestle, but I think that's probably what everyone expected, really. And I think South Africa probably came out of the box flying. I think at halftime, everyone probably thought they had it well under control, but I think the Lions did well to come back and win the game, because I think South Africa are a very difficult team to beat once they get ahead, the way the style of play that they have.
I don't know. Some people say that they prefer the open style of rugby, that it's easier in the eye. I think when the stakes are as high as a Lions test, I think people can really appreciate an arm wrestle, as you put it, over the course of the weekend. Just the game being on a tightrope, especially, it was unbelievably tense.
Yeah, I mean, personally, I'd rather the game was a bit more open. It's a bit more entertaining. But, I mean, at test level, at the highest, it's understandable how teams play like that. And I mean, that's South Africa's DNA, really, and it's what won them the World Cup. So I don't think they're going to go away from that. And I think this week they'll probably do it even more. They'll probably kick even more than they did last week. And the Lions probably tried to, in the second half, they probably played a little bit more, and they probably reaped the rewards from it. So it'll be interesting to see what approach they take this week.
Was it good quality kicking, at least?
Yes and no. I think there was some very good quality kicks. I mean, you probably saw when the Lions scored, I think straight after halftime, the quality value prices, two box kicks, and I think the Lions ended up getting points off the back of both of them. It's difficult as well, I suppose, for the Springboks, because a lot of them haven't played really test rugby in 2 years almost, and obviously some of them having COVID as well, so it's tough to know exactly what impact that had on them, and even their preparation's been very interrupted. So it'll be interesting to see how they go this week. I think they could be a little bit stronger this week, but again, I think the Lions will be better because combinations will have all played last week and they'll have another week's prep. So I think it'll be a very interesting game.
Harry, what have you made of it?
Yeah, I found it very interesting. I watched that I completely binge watched the Chasing the Sun documentary yesterday for the first time, and it kind of reminded me a bit of that the semi-final of the World Cup between Wales and South Africa, where it was just a full arm wrestle, who's going to kick more and who's going to choke the other team, kind of basically out of the competition or out of the contest. Yeah, it was fascinating though, but yeah, as Ross said, that was the two peak moments for me. Those box kicks kind of after half time kind of really swung it for the Lions. I think got a few penalties. South Africa ill-disciplined a little bit. So I find that there were pretty close margins, particularly at that level. And I think, I don't know, it'll be interesting to see this week. I'm interested as well if the 6-2 split from South Africa, no 10 on the bench as well, is interesting. So they're obviously back in their starters to do a job and then bring on, as they call it, the bomb squad, as I was watching the documentary.
Who's going to do it? Who's going to win the series?
I think... It's going to be tough. If you ask me after next week, I'll give you an answer. But I think the Lions, to be honest, being 1-0 up, I think there's enough. There's probably enough players who've done it at such a high level that they can get over the line.
I think the Lions probably have a bit more depth in their squad. Particularly, I think in key positions, I think if they get an injury or two, I think they can still manage. Whereas I think South Africa, particularly because they probably haven't been able to build the depth over the last year or so since the World Cup. So I think the Lions squad is stronger, but if they win this week, South Africa, it'd probably be tough to stop them with the momentum into the third test.
If you were watching the Chasing the Sun documentary, you might not have had time, but have you guys been keeping an eye on the Olympics at all and the Sevens team?
I actually haven't been able to watch any of the games live. I watched just was it? Oh, what game? I didn't see the Stafford game. I saw the game after it. But no, I haven't really been able to keep up with it, massively. The time difference has been a bit of an issue, but more just checking on my phone, kind of following as it goes. It's obviously massively disappointing for the lads to finish where they finished, especially because they did so well to get there and there's so much work gone in to get them to the Olympics. And sure, they're very frustrated, but such a massive achievement still to be the first team to get there. I'm sure they'll be back in 4 years' time.
For sure, for sure. Hopefully the start of something for that team. Just to mention again that it's spearheaded by Leinster rugby players, brothers and competitors Harry and Ross Byrne. They're taking teams on a virtual run from the 2nd to the 16th of August from Dublin to Rome, covering the host cities of the Six Nations Championship. So on registrations for the race, participants will automatically be assigned to Team Ross or Team Harry, and it is pretty even, they say, with Ross and Harry acting as team captains. Each team will work towards the collective goal of running from the Aviva to the Stadio Olimpico and back, covering the host stadiums of the Six Nations, with the team that has clocked up the most kilometres by August 16th winning the race, but most importantly, winning the pride of the Byrne family. Runners and walkers of all ages and abilities are invited to take part. You can register now to clock your miles for Dublin Simon's Run at Home with Team Harry and Team Ross. And if you don't have time to run, you can buy some kilometres for your favourite team in the Dublin Simon Run at Home. I think you all at home know how important the cause is. It's an absolutely fantastic cause. And you can visit dubsimon.ie/runathome for all the details, and that includes donations. So please head on there, even if you're not willing to walk or run, and it is supported by Deutsche Bank. We will be updating you on the progress over the next little while. Harry and Ross Byrne, great stuff as ever. Thanks a million.
Cheers, Alan.
Thanks very much.
Yeah, Ross and Harry Byrne there in conversation with me yesterday. OTB AM is brought to you by Gillette. Good morning, start with Gillette. Put your best face forward with their new and improved razors. Tomorrow morning on OTB AM, we'll be hearing from Alan Quinlan ahead of the second test in South Africa. There's our GAA quick picks, the crappy quiz, and all the Olympics reaction you need. Stay tuned to OTB Sports Radio throughout today. 1 o'clock sees Jerry Eisenberg talking about Muhammad Ali. From 3 o'clock, there's the History of Sport Episode 9 with Paul Rouse. And then the Olympic show is up from 5 o'clock. Live from 5 o'clock throughout the Olympics as we bring you the biggest stories of the day and also take a look ahead to what's coming up. It'll all be brought to you in association with Indeed, who are proud to support Team Ireland at the Tokyo 2020 Games. Indeed believes the world works better when people are given every opportunity to unleash their true talents. Hashtag talent unleashed. From 6 o'clock then it's OTB Gold at that great interview on Centaur, that sportsbook, and then from 7 o'clock as ever, Off the Ball is live on air and on the OTB Sports app.
What does innovation sound like? It sounds like the luxury of being in the moment with your customer, client, or patient. It sounds like having the right information right when you need it. It sounds like being at your best for your customers and your business. Thanks to Hyland's intelligent content solutions that improve digital processes, innovators everywhere are able to do their thing better, whatever that thing is. Now, who doesn't like the sound of that? Hyland, for innovators everywhere, visit hyland.com.